spaceship orbiting your mind. Here's the ATS Live crew. The British Maestro, Baz Badra, The Copper, Garth Holt, the godfather of ATS Radio, Johnny Anonymous.
Good evening, everybody. This is Neff. You are listening to Above Top Secret Live. Good evening. How are you? It is Saturday, the 23rd of April, 2011. We are live across the globe. Hello to our listener in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, our listener in Saint-Pierre-d'Aldrac in Aquitaine, and in Kojé in Sjælland in Norway. Hello to you. Nice to have you on board. Hello to the listeners in the City of London as well. We're live all the way across the world on the internet. We are currently live on KCKN Roswell, New Mexico on 10:20 a.m. and WLVJ Miami, Florida on 10:40 a.m. It's great to have you with us on this Saturday evening. We have a really full show for you tonight. In the studio with me at the present moment in time, I have some of the best and the brightest minds on ATS, and I'm going to start by introducing the one and only, my wingman, who's been a bit poorly, but I hope he's feeling better. Semper is with us. Garth, hello, how are you?
Hey, hold on one second, Neff. Hello, sir, I'm Captain Garth Holt. You've been stopped for doing 45 out of 25. I'm going to get a license registration and your cell phone, please. Neff, I'm doing fine, how are you? Sorry, I was just taking
okay.
Traffic stop while we're on it.
Yes, traffic stop. We'll get to that a bit later on. We will. And if you're wondering what he's on about there, all will be revealed a little bit later. Taking your calls to our studio this evening, should you wish to ring us, and we hope that you will. Joey is with us. Hello.
Evening, Neff. Evening, gentlemen. Evening, Florida. Evening, Roswell. Evening, Internet. Evening, world. How is everybody doing this beautiful Saturday night?
I think everybody's doing swimmingly. I don't know what the weather's like where you guys are, but over
it's
here
blowing
in the UK,
a gale is what it's doing.
Is it really?
Yes.
It has been roasting over here. It has been the hottest April on record in the UK. Our temperatures were up in... It won't sound very high to you people in the middle of the States or anything like that, but 77 degrees in April in the UK is virtually unheard of. My current studio setup here is roasting, and I don't have air conditioning, which is a shame. But there you go. It's been great over here. Getting back to the introductions. Returning and fast becoming a regular on the show, we have Manny with us. Good evening. How are you?
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you. I'm doing very well. I hope everyone else is too.
Good. Also coming back and also becoming a slight regular on the show, we have Doug with us. Hello there.
Can you hang on just one second then? Flatfoot, I don't care what your radar showed. I wasn't doing that speed. Okay, I'm sorry. Hello to Florida and New Mexico and all of ATS.
Yeah, you can't repeat what's just been put in our little studio chat there. but that would be the next step, definitely. Definitely. You heard him giggling in the background there. Jack is with us. Hello there.
Don't tase me, bro. Don't tase me.
Just, don't tase me.
He's got the whole studio locked down.
Yeah, we are in lockdown. What scares me is there's going to be some TSA patting down going on in a bit as well, which is just a bit scary. Back of your hand, right? Yeah. Always the back of your hand, definitely. Last but not least...
It depends on what she looks like, man.
Oh, why did I know that was coming?
Don't go there.
I think we all knew that was coming.
Yeah, he went there, didn't he? He had to go there.
This program is brought to you by AboveTopSecret.com.
No, I don't. That's the wrong one. It's going to be one of those tonight.
Professionals, we are all professionals.
Professionals.
That's right.
Yeah.
The views and opinions presented by the hosts and guests of ATS Live do not necessarily reflect or represent the views of the Above Network LLC or AboveTopSecret.com.
You have just been simperized.
last but not least, in our studio queue here, chomping at the bit with his dentures falling out, the grandfather of ATS Radio, Johnny Anonymous, is with us. Hello there, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I would like to have my own disclaimer, if I may, which is I do not wear dentures, nor am I a grandfather. The above comments were not necessarily true. Today is a weird day. It is the 23rd of April, and I was looking through if there were any weird holidays that were on this day of the 23rd, and apparently there are. Today is National Movie Theater Day, International Marketing, and Talk Like Shane.
Talk Like who?
Marconi, when his first broadcast was done from my hometown.
Oh, is that right?
All of his towers and stuff were built in an area called Tablehead in my hometown.
That's awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
That is cool.
And then he moved over to Newfoundland to do the rest of it.
And if it wasn't for Marconi, we wouldn't be here, probably.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I like mine with cheese. That's...
No, no.
What, your Marconi?
That's macaroni. I'm sorry. Yeah,
that's macaroni. Yeah. Yes. What can we say about that?
There is one other weird holiday today, and apparently it is geared towards Garth. It is Bulldogs Are Beautiful Day.
I'm a cop, you idiot.
God. Somebody's let Semper loose with Garth. Somebody's let Garth loose with the special effects machine, so you'll have to excuse him this evening. We're working on a cure for it, but it involves tying him up in one of those funny white jackets where his arms are behind his back and putting him in a padded shell. And frankly, he's a big guy and we're having trouble getting him in it, yeah. But yes, the taser will come out shortly. Hello to our listener
in Arnhem. The key to his cage, you know that.
Yeah, I know. And he didn't do a very good job of it, did he? Break out the taser. Joey, yeah, I know you really want to do it, so just tase him. Just restrain him a little bit.
I'll save that for August. I'll save that for August.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe we can do that.
Live tasing. Actually, now people complain about
tasing. I will have the
motor
running in the car, though. That I can guarantee.
We could try that, couldn't we? I did see, actually, in the news where some guy in, I think it was in Florida, was killed by a taser the other day. Did some public order offence, and he was tased by an off-duty policeman, and he died. Which is a bit nasty, really.
Oops.
Oops. Yes.
Oops.
Oops. Shouldn't really make fun of that, but there you go. Hello. I'm going to try. I'll say hello to this listener one way or another. Hello to our listener in Arnhem in Gelderland. Arnhem has a particular significance for me. My grandfather served there in the Second World War. And unfortunately, things went a bit wrong. Hello to listeners in Beckley, West Virginia, in Toronto, Ontario, West Roxing, Massachusetts, St. John, New Brunswick, and Oakland, California. Great to have you with us today. Oh, and hello to Sydney in New South Wales. With Australian listeners as managed to get up to listen to us. And did I say hello to Saint-Pierre de Aurillac in Aquitaine before? Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But
doesn't even sound like English. How would we know if you said hello to them? Say hello to Haka Waka.
French.
And look, French. Antarctica just popped up. There it is.
It's not Antarctica, that's Australia.
Oh.
It's
damn
Australia.
It.
One day, your prince will come. And also one day, you'll get it right. You know, but it's United States Marines geography there. You know, if he hasn't blown it up, he doesn't know where it is. And that's the way it goes. Oh, hello to Mastic in New York as well. Nice to
Neff, can I get in one quick thing before we get into our subjects?
Somebody
messaged me a little while ago and asked me to say happy birthday to AboveTopSecret.com member Dave Spanners. They didn't tell me how old he was, but I won't make a guess judging by his posts. That would be unfair.
Yeah, Dave's as old as the hills, apparently.
He's a fellow countryman of mine.
Yeah, fellow countryman of mine. I would imagine he's pushing 80, something like that. but you know we love you, Dave, don't you?
Good for him.
One of these days he'll tell us how old he is. But there you go. At the moment, he hasn't done. Hello to our beloved chat room on AboveTopSecret.com. There's 30 people, 32 people in there now at the moment. And if you want to be a part of that experience, you have to come and join AboveTopSecret.com. Make a few posts. There's a qualification period to get into the chat room. But if you get into the chat room, you will speak with some of the nicest people you'll meet on the internet. All of them are extremely clever. All of them are quite opinionated. And they like to discuss the alternative side of the media. And that's what we're going to do this evening. And that's what we're here for. And we're going to start off with one of those topics that, unless you pay attention to the internet and to boards like ours, you probably won't have heard of. But this particular topic has Semper being tasered. There it is. Great.
Again.
Wonderful. Yes. Tase him, bro. Just tase him. This particular topic, as I say, it has particular relevance to just about everybody. Now, if you have an iPhone, or if you have a Droid phone, or if you have a Windows phone, you need to listen up, because something a little bit sinister is going on. Now, this has come up on our board at AboveTopSecret.com a couple of times. The thread that we've pulled out, just to reference it, is by ATS member, I think it's Elias, so it's meant to be Elias or Elias, but it's spelled E-L-1-A-5. The thread is called Government Officials Want Answers on Secret iPhone Tracking. Now, this is quite disturbing. It appears that certain applications that you can get for the iPhone or for Droid phones or for Windows phones are capable of being remotely activated to track your location. And this is happening on a more regular basis. Now, we did some research into this. We did a bit more digging on it. And we found another article on the computerworld.com blog, which gave a lot more insight into the problem. I'm going to throw Manny under the bus here and get the conversation rolling, and we'll carry on from there. So, Manny, just start us off here.
It's amazing. No matter how hard I tried to hide behind Garth, you still saw me. Thank you. Actually, I'd like to say I was rather amazed to hear about this, only because I had always been under the impression that this wasn't a surprise. You know, this technology has existed, I think, for a couple of years. It just never became quite so well known as it has recently in the case of Apple, and I think I know why. As it turns out, Apple has had a tremendously profitable year, and much of that profit, and I may be mistaken, if someone in the chat room might want to correct me if I'm wrong, or if you gentlemen know if I'm wrong, but I believe they had a 46% increase in profit, which is an amazing, when you consider the size of Apple, an amazing amount of money, and that it was mostly driven by sales of the iPhone in China, which we know happens to be perhaps one of the most, I believe it is one of the most intrusive governments insofar as tracking its people, after maybe North Korea. The truth is, I recently heard reporters interviewing people, and it turns out that these phones are actually writing a file, a hidden file, on your phone's operating system, because phones now really they're really small computers. They're not really just a headset, a receiver, and a transmitter. It doesn't work that way anymore. They're writing files tracking your GPS location 9,000 times a day. Meaning that, I mean, if you had an application where you could pull this information out, you could actually watch on the screen, you know, where you went and where you were at any given moment of the day. This information is troublesome, to say the least, when you think of the fact that you're not told that that information is on that device. I think a lot of people needed to know that, or would have liked to have known that, before they bought it. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there. That's a little fact. And if I'm mistaken, please correct me. Thank you.
No, I don't think you are mistaken. That's part of the issue here. The Computer World article says that application makers are using their apps to kind of remotely bug people. And some of these apps that you download, although they tell you that they may access certain functions of your phone, what they may be doing is activating your phone's microphone to collect sound patterns, tracking your location via the GPS, may actually be using the camera on your phone to take an image without you knowing it, and then transmitting that back to a central file where the data is collected. Now, the application manufacturers are saying that the stuff that they gather is not necessarily personally identifiable. But some of these applications take the unique device identification number as well and submit that back, which means that it is identifiable. And that's quite scary if you think about it, because that means that somebody, if they want, for nefarious reasons, can literally track your entire life and just run with it, take it away. Now, the other thing that I found out this week is some people had managed to hack the GSM banding on phones as well, so that you can pick things up from a couple of hundred feet away. You can hear a conversation on the phone. You don't need any particularly specialist information for it. They've actually cracked the encoding for that, which is quite interesting. And GSM, Johnny, you know, Stu, as you say, GSM is the encryption for your mobile phone, basically. So when you're speaking, the phone breaks up, or the phone signal is broken up into packets and sent off as it's transmitted. And these guys have actually cracked the GSM. It's supposed to be one of the most secure codes that you can get to prevent your phone technology being... to prevent your phone call being eavesdropped on. These guys have actually just messed it up and completely cracked it, which is a bit scary, really. Johnny, you've got some thoughts. Go on.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that, and by the way, if I suddenly drop out, my apologies, I'm not at my normal computer and internet service. One of the things that, to me, I find curious and disturbing both is that when we are on our own home internet-based system and we go to somewhere and or have a piece of software or application that we want to install, generally there is something that's called a EULA. And the EULA is an agreement that you will not share that software, reverse engineer it, blah, 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 all that pertinent stuff that probably 99.99 of us have never read. It's the end user license agreement. What happens with a lot of these cases is when you decide to have the software in your system, you will have a small little DLL or VXD that is attached to it so that it can update itself from the software company that you have purchased the application from. What I find disturbing in what I'm hearing here with the wireless thing is they are doing this, if I understand this correctly, without our knowledge, at least until this news broadcast was made available for us to find out. And I have to wonder if there might be some form of legalities involved in this. Has anyone else considered this? How can they do this without our explicit agreement, as is the case in most applications and software that we put on?
Because usually they put very, very general statements within agreements, user agreements, warranties, very general statements that can be easily molded to mean many things. I'm pretty sure you'll find in almost every one of these cases that the agreements include things like we will use what technologies we developed to continue this process, you know, or something along those lines. And that's like an open, you know, it's a blank check is what it is. And does the end user really care when they get their shiny new iPhone? Usually no. But maybe now they might.
It's the last thing you think about, isn't it? When you get your new phone and you really don't think about it. Just give it. I've got a list here of what some of the things that these bugs, for want of a better word, can do. They can determine the following: your gender and the gender of the people that you talk to, your approximate age and the ages of the people you talk to, because they are linked through, your phone number is linked through Facebook, obviously, and your Facebook page gives you ages, which is, you know, set your Facebook privacy settings properly. The time you go to bed and the time you wake up, because your alarm clock is a function on your phone. What you watch on TV and listen to on the radio, through a combination of things. That could be through you looking things up on the TV guide, but also because if your phone is in your living room when you've got the television on, the microphone can be remotely activated to record what's happening at the time. How much of your time you spend alone and how much with others. And again, that's by the microphone being activated. Because if you're there and it's quiet and you're not talking, obviously it's not going to pick anything up. If you are talking, it will count the number of people that you are speaking to. It will be able to pick up whether you live in a big city or a small town, and that's through the GPS location on the phone. But also, what form of transportation you use to get to work, because you are tracked. So if you're in your car, these microphones will pick up your engine or your stereo or whatever that you've got in your car. If you're on a train, you'll be on a rapid transit system, it will pick up the speed and the direction that you're travelling in. If you're on a plane or whatever, you know, it's going to figure out where you are. It's extremely intrusive, and these things are being activated remotely by the software. Doug, you've got some thoughts. Go on.
I don't know about across the globe. I know this is a global concern, but I do know about here in Alabama, the law as far as, you know, can a party be recorded without their knowledge is absolutely no. Cases have been thrown out of court, even when there was implicit agreement by both parties that a conversation could be recorded. It's got to be explicit here. So I'm trying to understand how they're able to turn on the microphone and use, well, even get access to that when it's obviously a definite violation of law. I got a feeling that our local copper over there can answer this. What do you say, Garth?
Yeah, it's actually pretty simple. The thing that you have to remember is everything is legal until it's made illegal. For a number of years, it was actually legal to film the activities in a female's bathroom because there was no ruling as to whether videotaping a person violated their Fourth Amendment rights. That's the thing to keep in the back of your mind. So what we're dealing with here is new technology. Until it gets challenged, then you're going to have a problem. And I don't know anything about Alabama law, Doug. But I do know this, in 47 of the 50 states, recording of a conversation is perfectly legal as long as one side of that conversation knows they're being recorded. In other words, if I'm carrying around a tape player with me, then I can record anyone I want to. Now, let's not remember this too. Even in Alabama, it's not illegal to record somebody. It's illegal to use that recording in any way detrimental to the subject you recorded. There is nothing illegal about walking around with a tape player in your pocket and recording everything that's happening. Nothing at all. As long as you don't use that in a way that is detrimental to the people that you've recorded. See, that's where the problem is. So someone's going to have to show that what these phones are doing is detrimental to someone. Then it'll go to court, it'll go to the appellate level, then depending on what the decision is with the appellate level, it could wind up in the Supreme Court.
If it doesn't go to the Supreme Court, it's never going to come up. See, that's that's what you got to remember. Everything is legal until it's made illegal. And new technology always has a length of time, you know?
Does Doug, you've got some more thoughts. Go for it.
Well, I think he kind of answered my question. So what you're saying, just to be sure I'm understanding this right, is that it's not illegal to record. It's only illegal to use it against someone until there is a court decision saying it is illegal. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, correct. And the problem, Doug, is this is brand new technology. No one's challenged it. I'll give you an example, and this is just kind of a roundabout example. But do you remember when the Stalker radar units first came out for the police? They were brand new, new technology, worked on a separate wavelength.
Okay, I don't do much stalking, so no, I didn't. But
well, they're actually just called Stalker radars, and it's just a type of radar unit to determine speed. They were the first radar unit to come out that could actually determine the speed of multiple vehicles and tell you which vehicle was which. But anyway, they were given to numerous police departments all over the United States in a hope that someone would take them to court and challenge their technology, because until it got challenged, there was no ruling that you could go into court and testify to. When I go into court and testify to a radar stop, which I haven't done traffic in years, but I mean, nothing's really changed, I have to testify to the Supreme Court ruling that gives me the right to sit out on the highway and judge people's speed via a microwave device such as a radar. So that's what's happened here. You've got brand new technology, and until somebody takes this to court, I don't see as how there's anything anybody can do about it other than just stop buying the phones, you know, and then, you know, if enough people find out about it, it cuts down on their profit margin, then they'll quit doing it.
Well, and Joey.
It is just, let me say one quick thing there, Neff. It's sort of a given that as technology increases, you have two sides battling out. One side trying to use the technology for ulterior purposes, and the other side trying to control that. So I guess that is what we're seeing here.
Probably. Mm.
Certainly is. Joey, you've got some thoughts. Come on.
Well, it's just a question, I guess, more towards everybody but I and you on here. Is it the Fourth Amendment of your Constitution that guarantees your privacy? I don't know how it's exactly worded it, but to be safe from
unreasonable search.
Search and seizure, securing your own personal papers and effects and that sort of thing.
Sure. Would that
cover it? Would that be what they would have to challenge it in court? Would it be under a Fourth Amendment,
right?
Or is there would
not
there
necessarily
other on the statutes on the books that would
the problem, Joey, is the word unreasonable. See, that's the problem. And traditionally, every Supreme Court, depending on their conservative liberal leanings, has defined unreasonable as meaning different things. You know?
Yeah, and that's understandable.
Right. First, we're allowed a no-knock search warrant, then we're not allowed a no-knock search warrant. It just flip-flops. Now, Manny was getting ready, I think, to point out another legality it could be carried under. Go ahead, Manny.
No. If you're on a roll, go for it.
Well, the Fourth Amendment, it is the amendment to the Constitution that guarantees people to be secure within their persons, their places, their homes, and their papers from unreasonable search or seizure. And again, it's all about the reasonableness. So that's why it has to go to court, because prior to going to court, there's no legal definition for what's reasonable about what they're doing. Is what they're doing unreasonable? Now, everybody in the studio, I'm assuming from the comments, is assuming that what they're saying is you think it's unreasonable. Well, that's fine.
No.
The problem is that the court...
Actually, I wouldn't go there. I think that I'm not ready to say that what they're doing is unreasonable. I'm ready to say that the fact that they failed to disclose the magnitude of this application shows that there is an element of this which we cannot judge, that they're hiding something. And that means that we do need to take this to court. It isn't really about whether or not it's reasonable. It's about whether or not we can judge if it's reasonable, if they're, using tools to amass data I mean, let's face it. You know, information is now a commodity. That's what we did when we dropped the industrial side of the economic model. It all went to information. Now they're amassing all of this information. It's sort of like we're a gold mine, and they're just, you know, sucking out the nuggets. And we don't know what they're going to do with them. We don't know if there's any protection for them. We don't know if the government is going to use them for purposes. Are law enforcement going to use it for investigative purposes? What do we know about this stuff? Nothing.
That's where I wanted to go with it. I mean, there are laws on the books, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure they're here in Canada. I don't know about America again because, again, I'm not an American. But there are laws on the books that data mining is legal as long as it's done in certain ways. And, right. And I am sure that there will be language, as was mentioned earlier, in the end-user lease agreement that says in legalese that, you know, because we have this ability or capability in the near future, we will be using it. And, you know, it's if you agree, sign here sort of thing. I mean, how many people truly read those contracts that are passed to you when you buy cell phones? You know, you've got your three-year
plan
or whatever. I mean, it'd be less than 1% of the people, because most people don't understand what it says anyway. You have to understand legalese to be able to do it. And 99.9% of the population that isn't a lawyer doesn't understand it. So, it would be very easy for them to put the language that they need in there. And data mining is legal, if I'm not mistaken. And I think you said yes, did you not, Gar?
Yeah, it is.
As long as it's done in a particular manner. And I know it's legal here in Canada as long as it's done in a particular manner.
Right.
So I would assume that language is somewhere in the EULA. So, I mean, I don't think if this gets challenged, I think it would have to go all the way to, I don't know if it's happening in Canada yet, but like you said, I'm pretty sure it would have to go all the way to the Supreme Court to make a ultimate decision on it, especially if they have it in the end user lease agreement.
Absolutely. Yeah, until it goes to the Supreme Court, nobody will do anything about it. Yeah, go ahead, Neff. I'm sorry. We're about out of time, I think, aren't we?
And we're just due for a little break here. We're going to pick this up just after the break, but we've got a few
things. We'll be right back after we get this mess cleaned up.
Man, the news is confusing.
How so?
Well, this story here, no end to terrorism.
They're just scaring you.
You're not worried about this stuff?
Yeah, but that's why I go to AboveTopSecret.com.
AboveTopSecret.com? That conspiracy site you showed me once?
Yeah, but it's so much more than that.
When the news lets you down, there's only one place to go. AboveTopSecret.com, the alternative to mainstream news for people who think. AboveTopSecret.com, deny ignorance.
Feeling better?
Yeah, thanks.
You are listening to the saviors of late night radio. Above Top Secret Live.
And we're back live. Before the break there, we were just talking about the mobile phone thing. And just to give you an indication of the apps that we're talking about, the ones that you may use to... you know when you're looking for a particular song and you can put your phone up to something and it will identify the song? It's that kind of application that you've got to be wary of. I'm not going to name specific ones. The article on Computer World, you'll be able to find it. It's called Snooping. It's not a crime. It's a feature. Go and look at it. It is a very, very... enlightening. Johnny's got a quick comment, I think. Go on.
Yeah, based on excuse me, what you were just saying about the snooping, you know, what we've been discussing here with what these apps are doing and keeping track of your movement, your information, where you go, that to me reminds me of what probably any agency of the government would love to be able to have at their disposal. And even though we haven't been able to establish what it is exactly that these companies are doing with this information, one has to wonder if something, I'm not going to use the term nefarious, but if something could be used sort of in that light or manner by someone else other than these companies. Has someone else thought about something like that?
It's probably, yeah, I mean, it's data mining, isn't it? And you can just literally take what you've got and just nick it and sell it on. That's what bothers me. Apparently these things don't necessarily record full conversations. They record little bits, little snippets and audio and things like that. Very, very interesting stuff. Somebody in our chat room above topsecret.com has suggested that we run an experiment to try and see what one of these things is doing. I think that's a good idea. And I wonder if we can manage to do that somehow. We've got some very technical people on abovetopsecret.com. Would be interesting to find out exactly what one of these phones is doing. Manny, you've got a bit more here, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, you know, is there a possibility that this could be, not to sound cliche, but as opposed to for else. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what if this kind of information that all these iPhone users have could tell us something along the lines of, oh, you know, there's been an earthquake. How can we locate people? Well, we have their iPhones. We can dig down in there and find out where their last location is and go get them.
Different thing, Manny. Yeah. Different. Before you get in too far into this, that's a different thing. The location, every smartphone and almost all cell phones now have 911 locators, and it's called a 911 locator. I don't know why, but it is a a signal where this phone is connecting to the satellite. Your location can be found on your cell phone at any time. That has nothing to do with the data mining. That was something that was put into place.
No, I understand that.
Quite some years ago.
That data is based on an interpolation of information between how far you are from cell towers. These phones do not communicate with a satellite. They communicate with the cell tower.
Yes.
The towers communicate to the satellite. A satellite phone is a completely different animal.
No, it's all GPS now. My droid is a GPS device. It connects directly to the global positioning satellites. And iPhones do, all your smartphones do, and you can get a GPS. I can be tracked to within something like 1 foot of my location.
Then why do we have this proliferation of cell towers all over the country?
Because the cell towers carry the voice signal. The data signal for a GPS location is very, very small. Nothing compared to the transmission of voice. See, that's what you got to understand. There's all different sorts of things your phone's doing. You know, connecting to the internet, voice transfer protocols, voice over internet protocols with Skype, 911 locations, GPS information. They're all, you know, all of those are different and different animals, for lack of a better word, that your phone does.
Can I jump in here just a minute?
You're
not quite accurate on that. No phone, no item communicates with the GPS satellites. They only output data. They do not input at all. What your GPS device does is it takes the signal that's being generated from these geostationary satellites, and using that, it interprets where you are. It does not communicate with the satellites. The satellites only communicate with it.
So you understand communication can be one-way communication, right?
Say again, please.
Understand it, right? My comment about it communicates with the satellite, I know exactly what you're talking about. You do understand communication could be one-way communication. It doesn't have to be both ways, right?
It's not communicating with the satellite. The satellite is communicating with it, and that is a major difference there, because there's no way that your phone can send a signal to the GPS satellite about your location. GPS satellite doesn't know, doesn't care. It has to send your location through another route.
I'm just using the terminology that is used by the courts and by the cell phone manufacturers, the fact that your phone communicates with satellite. It is one-way communication, absolutely, but it is communication less.
It is communication, I'm afraid somebody will get the idea that, oh, my God, my telephone is sending a signal to this satellite. It will send a signal to the communication satellite. Now, that's a two-way communication, but the GPS does not send a signal anywhere. It only gives you that signal.
No.
Then the phone can send it wherever it wants it.
Your phone is a GPS receiver. It's the software in the phone that then translates that data and broadcasts it via the cell network to whoever wants to collect it. That's how it works. It's
thank you. It's that's just exactly one of those things.
Yeah, Johnny, you've got a bit more.
Yeah, I had another quick query, if I could. I know that in the past, in some of the rescue attempts made to people that are either lost in the mountains or have gotten them into some type of precarious area that is away from, say, some metropolis, say in the woods or whatever, sometimes I have heard that they have asked the people to leave their cell phone on so that they then can track and find them. What is it right. that is being used at that time then, if it's not a GPS type system, for them to be able to locate such lost people or injured people?
Johnny, I've located people with the GPS on the cell phone. We located a person making bomb threats just last year, utilizing, she had a smartphone, it was a lady, she had a smartphone and she had it on, and we were able to locate her to within a foot. We were able to tell she was in the living room of her house because of that.
Yeah, and what it's doing is it's
a different situation, though. Go ahead, Nev. I'm sorry.
Well, what's happening there, and what these people are doing is they are allowing the phone to pick up the GPS signal, and then you can send a radio signal or a mobile phone signal to the phone and get the coordinates of where the phone is through that method.
Okay.
So that's a two-way communication. Yep. So that's how that works. Yeah, let's just move forward a little bit, because there's something more sinister, or something else sinister, that's going on with these mobile phones. That's what's happening remotely. Now, if you didn't know, dear listeners, Garth here is a serving police officer. And it appears that some of his colleagues are being a little bit nefarious during traffic stops. I'm going to let Garth explain this one and start us off. Do you want to start us off with this one and go for it?
I would absolutely be happy to. It's off of a AboveTopSecret.com member, Blazer, B-L-A-Z-E-R. And it's misleading. And here's why it's misleading. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, that wonderful, wonderful liberal organization we all know and love, they don't know if any policeman has scanned a phone on a traffic stop yet or not. They're just afraid they might do it, because the forensics device that's used to scan cell phones, like everything else, has become very small, very portable. It's something you can put in your pocket, and basically you plug it into the data port on any cell phone, particularly smartphones, and it will download everything off of that phone, all of your use statistics, your phone calls, your text messages, your pictures, your song, you name it, it downloads it. Now, the problem here is the ACLU is chomping at the bit on this, saying, well, it's a possibly, it's an invasion of privacy, blah, blah, blah. Now, here's the thing. If a policeman pulls up to you and he says, I've stopped you for doing whatever, okay? And he's actually an interdiction officer. I worked interdiction for about 10 years. More like 12 years. I'm old. But anyway, when you do interdiction, the goal of the officer on an interdiction stop is to search your car and everything in it. Interdiction is stopping a vehicle in order to check it for illegal substances, Manny, drugs specifically, firearms specifically. You know, the interstate transportation of firearms is big nowadays.
So interdictions are warranted then?
Well, it's a team. It's called an interdiction team. And the idea is you stop vehicles and certain things catch your eye, and those things raise what's called the level of reasonable suspicion. Once you obtain reasonable suspicion, you begin working toward obtaining probable cause. The working aspect of it actually is interviewing the people inside of the vehicle, using the plain view doctrine, anything that's laying around in the vehicle, that sort of thing. But anyway, so what the ACLU is saying is that the police can actually, you know, take your cell phone, plug it into this device, and violate your privacy. Well, here's the problem. They can't do it without your permission, number one, or a warrant, because That's a direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. I'll guarantee you that there's no court in the land that won't uphold that. But here's what I'm going to tell you. In 12 years of doing drug interdiction, I only ever had one person tell me they could not, that I could not search their vehicle. And I'm talking about people would give me permission to search their vehicle, and I would find, without exaggerating here, 2 kilos of cocaine, a bale of marijuana, you name it.
Why would they do that? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a psychological concept. Well, you're cued, so, you know. It's a psychological concept. It, you know, I could explain it to you, but it's
understand. You know, it's too in-depth.
It's, well, it's very unknown still. You know what I mean? They don't know why. They just do. You know?
Okay, I can accept that.
But they don't know why, they just do. It's, that's almost like a Pavlovian response then. Is that what you're saying? That, you know, because mm-hmm. it's an authority figure. It's Pavlovian. And apologies, listeners, if you just heard that. That's me pouring a drink because I'm absolutely bashed. Right, so what you're telling us here, Garth, is that people voluntarily allow police officers to violate their civil rights because they don't know better.
No. It's not a violation once they give permission.
Right.
See, then okay. It's not a violation. You know, if I ask you if I can search your body and you say yes, hey, there you go. I've got permission. Fourth Amendment's out the window. You see what I mean? The Fourth Amendment only protects you if, and I'll tell you, the guy in the actual thread, not the ATS thread, but the link, explained it very, very succinctly. The Fourth Amendment is an on-off type of thing. If I say, may I search your car, and you say, no, Fourth Amendment's on, baby. The only way I can search your car now is with a court order or the development of probable cause. Okay? If I say, may I search your car, and you say, yes, Fourth Amendment's off. Doesn't apply. See what I mean?
Okay. Is there a requirement to explain that to people when they are stopped?
And if okay.
not, why not?
Here's where it gets sticky. Different states have different requirements, but on a federal level, I do not have to tell you that you have the right to refuse me.
Nor should you.
Okay, all I have to do is ask you, okay, on a federal level. Now, different states are different. In South Carolina, I'm required to tell you, you have the right to refuse this. In the state of Delaware, right. I'm not. All I had to do was pull you over and say, can I see your cell phone? I would like to see what's inside your cell phone. And if you say yes, which most people do, you'd hand me your cell phone, and I've got it.
Okay. So... really, this whole thing relies on the ignorance or non-ignorance of the person who is approached at the time. Manny, you've got some thoughts here.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly amend what I said because I wanted it to be understood. I firmly believe that we should be in a position where we trust the judgment of a duly trained law enforcement officer to make the decision that a person merits extra scrutiny. I agree with that. That's, you know, that's what they're there for. However, the idea of an interdiction team, for example, going out, you know, just randomly hunting for somebody and then, you know, using the different cues that they use to determine whether or not there's probable cause, is kind of frightening to me. Only because...
Well, that's not how it works, Manny. It's not really how it works.
Everything you described as what they use as a trigger, or what would be used as a trigger to say, I'm going to search your car, okay?
I have
probable cause. Are stuff that any law officer would have to react to. I mean, open
more
view
or less.
Is open view. Does it whether
well,
or not you're
not really.
Right?
But Manny, not really. Well, no, because, you know, when you're trained in interdiction, and it's a long school, you look for certain things, okay? The single male passenger, okay? And then when you pull him over, then inside of his vehicle is a couple of McDonald's bags, no luggage, okay? The car is squeaky clean, And then you ask him where he's coming from, and he says Vermont, which may be, let's say, for instance, a 14, 20 hours away. Okay? So that starts, you know, that starts piquing your interest, okay, because most people would have a bag of luggage or, you know, some clothes or something in the car if you're traveling that far, okay? So then you begin, you know, the interrogation, or not the interrogation, but the interview. You know what I'm saying? You follow along with me? Two males, no luggage, fast food wrappers. And the fast food's key because they don't want to stop. They won't go in and eat because, let's say, they're mules and they're carrying dope from New York to Florida. Sure. They can't stop because they have a delivery time they have to meet down in Florida. So, well, I'm sorry, it would be guns from New York to Florida and dope from Florida to New York. So let's say they got a load of guns. They have to meet whoever it is they're giving these guns to. These people are just getting paid to transport. So they're not a lot of fast food because they're going to do a lot of drive-throughs, okay? Because they're not interested in that. They're just going down there, dropping it off, turning around, and coming back up. So all of this stuff is what cues you, you know, and that starts the reasonable suspicion process, yes.
Okay. Well, like I said, I mean, I would, in my ignorance, I assumed that all police officers would be, you know, using this, that kind of, you know, assessment tool, not just ones that went to a special school. So I didn't realize that. I'm assuming they give some kind of blanket warrant or something, right? So I mean, do you struggle with that whole nonsense every time someone says no?
You don't need a warrant most of the time, and I'll tell you why. First off, to ease your mind a little bit, most officers nowadays are trained in interdiction right in the academy. So, you know, you don't just have wild, sometimes you do, but as a rule, there's not just wild cowboy guys out there doing this stuff. They know what they're doing. And now remember, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, and Manny, you know this, does not cover vehicles as tightly as homes.
That's true.
You can get into a vehicle way easier than you can get into a home. You know, so that's huge. You know, all I need is good probable cause, and I can get that by bringing a dog up. If I think they've got dope, I can hold them for whatever length of time this individual state gives me. Here in South Carolina, it's any reasonable amount of time, and that's been defined as up to 4 hours, which means I get a drug dog up there. If he hits on that car, I'm going in the car.
Just define for our listeners what probable cause is, but bear in mind we're running out of time, so keep it.
Okay, all right, real quick. All right, first off, let's do reasonable suspicion, because that's what leads you to probable cause. Reasonable suspicion is any actions that may be observed that would lead a reasonable man to believe a crime had been committed. All right, now it's more technical than that, but that's the quick one. Probable cause are all the facts, circumstances, and evidence that would lead a reasonable man to believe a crime had been committed. So in other words, with probable cause, I've got to have something physical or something I can articulate. I can't just say he was acting suspicious, okay? But what I can say is when I walked up to the car, he was shoving something under his seat. That's probable cause, okay? Reasonable suspicion is when I walked up to the car, he was nervous, twitchy. He had a lot of McDonald's bags and no luggage. That's still just reasonable suspicion. But it's probable cause when I go walking up to his car and he's shoving something under his seat. There's your difference.
Right. So it's a very strange, a very slight distinction, I do believe.
It's
Joey,
slight, slight, but it's there. You know, I got to say that. And if it's slight, but it's there. And it's held very tightly by the courts. It really is.
Yeah. I can imagine. Joey's got some thoughts here.
On this line of thought that we're rolling on here, Garth, with the ACLU, what they're claiming here in Michigan, that the state troopers have used these, OEFD machines, I believe, yep, is what the acronym was.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're using these machines. If they have reasonable suspicion to think that a crime is being caused, would that give them would that give them the legal standing to be able to take things from people's cell phones on a routine traffic stop during an interdiction stop?
No.
they would need probable cause.
So it would have to raise to the level of probable cause before they have reason to be able to pull data and phone records and stuff from someone's cell phone on a traffic stop like that.
That's correct. And now that's just my opinion. But, you know, I used to teach this stuff, so, you know, I'm pretty well grounded in it. And I'm telling you, if they start pulling it off that phone without probable cause, they're in deep trouble.
And that none of that would be admissible in a court of law against them if after.
Right.
Okay, and another question. With these OEFD machines, is there a timestamp as to when they pull the information from the phone, or is it recorded in that manner, or would it be something that would be just pulled from the phone, and if, okay, it went from reasonable suspicion to probable cause, could they say, well, we took it afterwards?
I can answer that later, Joey, but I believe
we're running out of time. I'm sorry.
We are out of time. We're going to go to a break here. Just to summarize very quickly there, what we're saying is if you get stopped by a police officer and they ask if they can scan your phone, you do not have to say yes. That's the bottom line of it. And hopefully there may be some ATS members out there who were concerned about that who now aren't, or even some people listening on AM who aren't ATS members who now are slightly more enriched by the power of AboveTopSecret.com. We've got to go for a break. It's time once again for Mondo Bizarro, and we'll be back with a special guest interview after this.
Johnny needs a four-letter word for love.
It's time once again for
Mondo Bizarro.
And here's what's been happening this week in Mondo Bizarro. A movie billed as the world's first 3D porn film has broken a box office record, even outselling Avatar on its opening day. Film fans flocked to see 3D sex and zen after it opened in packed cinemas across Hong Kong. Set in the Ming Dynasty, it tells the tale of a sexually frustrated scholar who realizes his ex-wife is the true love of his life. The production is a remake of a 1991 Hong Kong movie by the same name. Producer Stephen Hsu said, "We met people's expectations. People have always thought you needed 3D technology for this kind of content. So people were obviously very curious." The original 1991 film Sex and Zen is still the highest-grossing Hong Kong adult movie of all time. A dispute between two warring circus clans left six people wounded, police said overnight, after confiscating guns and other weapons from the performers. Police said it was unclear what sparked the melee yesterday between the two families, who were each camped on the eastern fringe of the southern German city of Regensburg. Neighbors reported hearing shots, and police arrived to find a 48-year-old with a bullet wound in his leg and another five people between the ages of 17 and 55. With minor to moderate injuries. Each of the families claimed three victims. It is still a complete mystery what led to the massive run-in between the two families from the circus scene, police were reported saying. Authorities seized three guns, several knives and batons, as well as band implements such as brass knuckles. A U.S. lawman known as America's Toughest Sheriff has released a series of mugshots online so the public can vote on their favorite. Sheriff Joe Aprio allows users to browse through the photos on his website and then vote for the mugshot of the day. He is previously best known for dressing prisoners in pink underwear and feeding them green bologna. Sheriff Aprio of Maricopa County, Arizona, says he came up with the mugshot of the day idea to give the public a voice in law enforcement. He hopes it will highlight the work of his officers and help solve more crimes by making people more aware of local offenders. Sheriff Aprio rose to fame in 1993 when he started Tent City Prison, which now has nearly 2,000 prisoners serving their sentences under the canvas.
Bizarro fact.
Researchers have found a way to make mouse hearts glow green each time they beat. The feat was accomplished by creating genetically altered mice by modifying and inserting a gene from a jellyfish known for its ability to fluoresce. Not only that, researchers can turn the glowing feature on and off at will. The risk of being struck by a falling meteorite for a human is one occurrence every 9,300 years.
From the Strange Law Department comes this. In Washington State, there is a law against having sex with a virgin under any circumstance. This includes one's wedding night. Central air conditioners use 98% more energy than ceiling fans. A group of flightless birds from New Guinea are known as cassowaries. They communicate through the dense foliage of the jungle by means of extra-low frequency sound waves, just below the hearing range of humans. A cesium atom in an atomic clock beats over 9 billion times a second. Well, that's going to do it for this installment of Mondo Bizarro. Stay tuned for more stuff as we turn it back over to ATS Radio.
And now, coming to you live from the belly of the mothership orbiting your mind, here's the ATS Live crew. The British Maestro, Baz Badrock, The Copper, Garth Holt, the Godfather of ATS Radio, Johnny Anonymous.
We're back live. You are listening to Above Top Secret live on this Saturday evening. It's great to have you on board with us. Big hello to anybody that's joined us listening on WLVJ in Miami, Florida on 10:40 a.m. and also to our listeners in KCKN Roswell, New Mexico on 10:20 a.m. And anybody out there who's listening on Global Star Satellite Network, it's nice to have you with us. And also to our friends across the world on the internet. And I'm just going to pull up my little map here with a bit of luck and see if anybody's joined us recently. Oh, yeah. Hello to listeners in Springfield, Missouri, Redsville, Georgia, and there was one in Australia, and it's gone off my little screen now. I think it was Perth. Hello to Perth in Australia. And we still have our listener in Saint-Pierre d'Aurillac in Aquitaine in France. Great to have you on board. Really is. Oh, and we've just been joined by Redsville in Georgia. Nice to have you with us. First hour, we've covered all sorts of strange subjects to do with telephony and being bugged and stuff like that. We have a special guest to interview in the studio this evening, a man by the name of Ralph Ring from BlueStarEnterprise.com. Ralph, it's great to have you with us this evening. How are you?
Well, thank you so much. I'm doing fine, thank you.
That's cool. That's cool. It's very, very much appreciated if you come in, for you to come on the show. I'm going to hand the reins over to Johnny because I know that you've dealt with Johnny before. And I'm going to let Johnny do the introductions for you and take us through into the interview here. So, Johnny, go for it.
Thank you very much there, Neff. And once again, I want to remind everybody that because of the setup and system that I have, I might go black here, and it's not by my own choice. So if it does, no need to worry. It's not HARP, I don't believe, at least at this time. Our interview is going to be with a very multi-talented man by the name of Ralph Ring, who back in the late 1950s and early 1960s worked with a protege of the great underappreciated inventor Nikola Tesla, and he worked with this gentleman by the name of Otis T. Carr. Ralph believes that you must always work with Mother Nature. Force is never necessary. The laws of the physical universe are really very simple. Our continuing endeavor is to reintroduce a better and safer form of transportation and habitation. His website is located at www.BlueStarEnterprise.com, and Blue Star Enterprise is all one word. We are proud to have with us here on Above Top Secret Live, Mr. Ralph Ring. Hi, Ralph. How are you?
Hi, Johnny. Long time no see. It's nice to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. You know, when I had a chance to interview you back in 2007, there were probably another 1,000 or so more questions that I would have loved to have asked you. So I'm hoping that perhaps we might be able to get into a few of those tonight. But before we actually get into some of the questions that many of our staff have with you, why don't you go through kind of a brief historical background of your life? Because it is truly fascinating. If I understand correctly, did you or were you not a part of the Jacques Cousteau team in the invention of the Aqualung?
Yes, I wasn't there at the at the time the Aqualung was invented, but I did work for U.S. Divers and Jacques Cousteau's company in Santa Ana, California. I was the head of the research department.
Wow. Very interesting. So now, how long were you on a part of that operation?
Well, it wasn't too long before I was, because I was a research and development diver, of course, I was known to already taken risks in my diving adventures. I had to, I was a test diver, so I tested many new devices underwater out by Catalina Island, and we went quite deep sometimes and quite long underwater. So I did have a few mishaps, and I was married at the time. I had children to raise, and my wife was getting nervous about some of the accidents that were occurring. I assured her there was nothing to worry about, but that lasted, I think, for less than a year until she said, "You've got to find a job." And the newspaper in my lap one morning, a lab tech at a place called Advanced Kinetics, located in Costa Mesa, right close to where I lived. And I told her I had only had military experience. I was a heavy weapons operator in Korea, and diving. That was what am I going to do as a lab tech? She said, "Well, you have all these experiments all over the house of little things running around with no wires and stuff. Just go in and show them, tell them what you do and how you do it, and your understanding of natural law, and see what it gets you."
Right.
And so
that actually makes a perfect segue, because I wanted to find out how you got into Advanced Kinetics. But why don't you tell our listeners, after you were actually hired to work with Advanced Kinetics, what were some of the projects that you were working on there?
Okay, well, it was a government-funded top research and development lab, and we had some restrictive areas that we were working on, but the one that I wound up with was magnetics, which has always been my favorite. I've loved magnetism ever since I was a kid, and I got hired even without a proper application, because they had lost the engineer that was working on the project. He just left, and they needed to get somebody on it right away, so they hired me. And what this was a simple, the concept was simple. The method for achieving it wasn't so simple. They had a cathode ray tube firing electrons through a magnetic field, you know, positive, negative on both sides. And my job, I was told, was to fire electrons through this field until I got one successfully through the field without deflection, without going to the negative or positive pole.
Uh-huh.
And for this, they gave me an oscilloscope, a giant oscilloscope and Polaroid camera. And then each shot I took, I had to take pictures of it and write up at the end of the day how many shots and where they went and the duration of the shots and so forth. Well, that became very boring after a while, because they were using brute force. And I was raised in the woods. I was raised in a place called Paradise, California. And I was raised inside the woods. I knew what natural law was, and that you don't really push Mother Nature around. So I thought, well, I can find a better way of doing this. And I said, I think I'll go home and try. Well, the next bench over, they were working on levitation, and they had these giant coils, igliotrons, as they were called in those days, and they check them out from supply at about $400 a copy, and that was kind of, that was in the 50s, so you know how expensive that was. And they'd fire up the coils and suspend a steel ball for about 3 or 4 minutes and burn up a coil, so they'd have to keep checking them out. So I thought, well, that's one form of levitation, and I think I can beat that. So anyway, long story short, I went home and tore apart some television sets, and I'd gotten an audio amplifier and some stuff at garage sales and stuff, and my lab at the time was, my garage was full of stuff, so I did a lot of work there, but my favorite spot was the living room floor, which didn't set well with my wife at the time, but I set up an identical experiment to the magnetic field experiment. I just set up a cathode ray tube, tore apart a television set, and got the magnets and got it all set up. And I knew from my experience and time with nature that you have to allow things to breathe. You have to. You have a nature. All things in nature have a pulse beat. There's a on and an off switch, if you will. And what this equates to is when I was in the woods, I noticed that when nature ran water down a hill, she didn't go in a straight line. She bounced it back and forth and meandered it down the hill. And there was tremendous power and tremendous cleansing, if you will, of the water. You could have a dead animal 10 feet up the path and be able to drink the water, you know, 10 feet downstream. So anyway, that being said, I said, well, I'm going to pulse the signal. I'm going to give this little electron a chance to do its thing by pulsing it, meaning I give it a delay. So I fired the electron and pulsed it, and the first one went through the field without deflection. And every one after that, I shot about 20 or 30 shots. Every one was successfully going through the field. So I thought, well, of course, it's just simple. This is just giving nature a chance to work with you, or you a chance to work with nature. Everything's quite simple. Well, I got a little cocky and said, I'm going to try the levitation thing. I tore apart a big speaker and took the woofer out of it, 15-inch woofer speaker, put it on the living room floor, attached the audio amplifier to it, and started playing around with different objects to see if I could obtain an acoustical levitation. I was interested in acoustical levitation because of a brief 8-millimeter film that I'd seen on the way they raised rocks in Tibet up the side of a cliff using acoustical sounds. They were using giant horns and drums. And they would get in resonance with these stones. These were heavy, big stones, and they would slowly levitate up the side of the cliff. So I said, "Well, sure, that's sound waves. You reach a resonant frequency of something, and you're going to change it." So I fooled around until I got a ping pong ball. Ping pong ball went in the center of it. I turned the knob, I don't know where I was at, probably 27, 28 hertz and cycles per second, and the ping pong ball suspended itself, and it stayed there all night. I went to bed, and I woke up in the morning, and it was still there. So I took pictures, I wrote up the experiments, I told my wife, expect a raise. We're going to get a new something around here, because I said these are quite simple little things that they were making difficult. And so I went in and I presented it to Dr. Weinhardt. He was the head of the institute. And I said, well, I played around with this at home, and I think I've got a, I'm not an engineer, but I think if I turn this over, they can take off on this, and we can have my experiment and the levitation thing on the way to success. Well, he had the door closed. He told the secretary no calls, and he said, now let's sit down and talk about this. And so we did, and I told him how I found it, and I told him that I am a firm believer in natural law, and that I believe in the first law of nature is what goes around comes around. So whatever you're going to do is going to come back at you one way or another. And we might as well do the best we can and have a good result. And I said, I think we're using brute force, and I don't think we're going to get far with that. And he says, well, I see what you've done here, and I know what you're doing, and I am a physicist, so I understand a little bit about natural law. But there's something you don't understand. This is a government-funded research and development facility. I said, yeah. And he says, well, we're paid to look for answers, not find them. And that was one of the greatest shocks they've had on this planet. I couldn't believe that he would say something like that, because it was just very simple experiments. Just any kid could do it if they spent time. But he said, no, this is, I'm going to have to shred this material, ask you to go back to work, don't talk to the engineers, and we'll have a little more pay in your envelope, but this is taboo, off limits, so don't talk about it.
Huh. That's pretty fascinating. You know what, as you've been telling your story, there's just been a score of questions that have popped up here and other staffers that would like to ask some questions. And before I toss it over here to Doug to ask his question, I just wanted to say that your story about seeing the film of the Tibetan monks being able to raise the rocks using horns, that reminded me of the biblical scenario of where the walls of Jericho came down after they were blowing their horns like that. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Same thing, exactly. It's all due with resonance. And this is the one area that present-day technology doesn't want people to know too much about. Because with resonance, you have an infinite power to change things when you understand how it works.
Right.
So that being said, and I am, for all those who are going to ask me questions, I'm just a country boy, really, at heart. I don't have a lot of technical jargon. I don't know if I can answer a lot of technical questions. I can equate them to what I know of nature and perhaps answer them in a way you'll understand, but I'm not an engineer. I'm not proficient even in public speaking, but I'm doing it because like Johnny and I like his show.
Sure. Well, you're doing fine, Ralph. You're doing fine. And I think I'm going to toss it over to who likes to affectionately be called the Redneck. And his name is Doug. And so, Doug, I know you had a quick query, so go ahead.
No, I've got a lot of queries, Johnny. Mr. Ring, it is a pleasure to meet you. My name is Doug, also known as the Redneck, and I'm a country boy, too.
All right. And my name is Ralph. You can call me Ralph.
Well, I appreciate it, Ralph. Call me Doug, or just call me Redneck, like most people do. I'll try to keep my questions from getting too technical. It's not my intention to make things technical on you. Just, you know, I may hit a few technical terms, and if you have a problem understanding, I'll try to put it in simpler language. What has really intrigued me about your story so far is the fact that you were using a cathode ray tube to inject electrons through an area. Did I understand that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And
yeah, there's just equated to a horseshoe magnet. I tore apart a magnet, and I had a negative and positive on both sides of the track, and then I just fired the electrons from the tube.
And they were just going through the center of this magnetic field, is that all?
That's correct. Now, it isn't the $20,000 gun that they had at the lab. Of course not. It was just what I thought that I could do, and so I was using just what I had to work with.
Okay. Well, you don't always need a $20,000 piece of equipment to do an experiment. I'm living proof of
that's
that.
Right.
If you saw this shop, you would understand. I'm not sure if you know the answer to this. Were all the electrons bending in the same direction? You know, electrons will bend as they go through a magnetic field. Were all of them bending in the same direction, or were you spreading the beam? Do you know?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand that, because all I knew was they were what I would equate to spiraling. I mean, of course, I couldn't see them, but when I had a Polaroid camera, and I was taking shots, and they seemed to be almost in a straight line. I mean, they would spiral, but they would go like a spiral or vortex right down through the center.
Okay, and you were getting levitation from this?
Yes.
And which direction was the levitation? Was it? Can you describe the direction of levitation as it compares to the spiral?
Well,
Was it like it was levitating along the center of the spiral or crossways of the spiral?
Well, I would have to say the full length of the track, which was about, I think it was about 2 or 3 feet long, and I would have to say it was the full length of the track.
Okay, so that I'm reading that as being in the same direction. In other words, the electrons direction. Were spiraling around the direction it was levitating in.
Yes.
Okay. That's extremely interesting, based on some experiments I have run in the past.
All right.
we're both kind of working on the same thing here. It seems just you have much more notoriety than I do.
Well, yeah, unfortunately in some cases, but I do.
Yeah. Well, second thing, I was looking at, I've been doing your website, and I'm interested in this Utron. I've got a drawing of it pulled up here, and it looks like a, how would I describe this? Two cones mounted back to back.
Yeah.
And they're in between. I'm sorry?
It's a double tetrahedron. It's a tetrahedron back to back.
Right. Now,
it's like a diamond.
What is that made of?
Well, we had different, in our experiment, we must have tried, scores of different material, but this particular one, it's probably the one you're looking at, is a T6 aluminum.
Okay, so aluminum.
We did have copper ones, too, so I'm not sure where we're at on that one. But
okay, I think somebody else, I'm kind of hogging things here. I'm so excited to make your acquaintance. I apologize to everyone for that. So I'm just going to toss it back to Johnny, and Johnny, send it where you will.
All right, Doug, thank you very much. And you know what, I believe that we'll probably discuss that a little more as we get a little further into some of the events and quests that Ralph has been involved with. Manny, I understand you had a couple of quick queries here. Manny, go ahead.
Well, the qualifier couple of and the qualifier quick may not exactly be accurate, but I will restrain myself. I'm sure you'll keep me honest. It is such a great pleasure to meet you, sir. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I have it's sort of a question. I think it's kind of going to be a little off the map, but I was wondering, you know, as you were describing your understanding of nature and natural law and how it brought you to understand almost in a different light than pure sort of myopic science looks at things. You understand the nature of the relationship between matter and it reminded me somewhat of the story of Victor Schoberger. Have you heard of Mr.
One of my favorite mentors. Yes, I like him.
I was always been very impressed by his work with vortexes, fluid flow. And it seems to me that those principles that he was sharing with us in his works seem to indicate that at a level that's, I don't know, not taught very well, I think, the world of physics is really easily visible in on a macro scale, on a large scale. As you say, you observe things, and you can imagine that if this is how things work between two stones and flowing water, why wouldn't it work that way between an electron stream and another piece of matter? And you used the word vortex, and it sort of perked up my ears. And I'd like to know if you believe that there is, for lack of a better word, like an ether, a medium in which matter sits. And that's what we're manipulating when we're pushing things through it and harmonically vibrating things. So there's some kind of granularity, if you – I'm sorry that this sounds kind of weird, I suppose, but to the nature of reality.
That's not weird at all. You sound like one of my compadres. Yes, oh. We talk about ethers like it was breakfast food, because that's the technology that we use in building prototypes and understanding the laws of nature over and above physical laws. We got into quantum mechanics, quantum physics, but we also got into understanding what our intuition is. It's a power beyond academia. And our intuition, once you know how to use it, and it will guide you to areas that you won't find in the present-day physics books, and how simple life is and how simple you can put things together and make them work. So you're talking the same language that we talk about, ether technology.
That's good. That means that my reading hasn't been in vain. I actually understood something. Thank you very much for confirming that. One of the folks in the chat room, one of our wonderful members, had asked a question. You mentioned quantum physics, and one of those things that's always very quirky about quantum physics is how the observer can affect the outcome at that level of what phenomena is happening. Do you believe that we have that kind of impact on the world around us?
Oh, absolutely. That's another one of my mentors, Heisenberg. I love that. Because every time it goes back again to resonance. Every time you resonate at anything, like tuning forks across the room or two guitars or two musical instruments, even pianos, when you hit a certain note, it will vibrate and resonate and strike the same note across the room.
Does that mean that both have to be the same material? Do they both have to share the same kind of physical form?
Yes and no. And the reason I say no is because it depends on the field you're working in. In the understanding of ethers, it has to do on a subatomic level. Actually, it's not the physical components altogether. If you're resonating on a subatomic level, you can resonate wood against metal or glass against steel, and it doesn't. But this is an area that's not properly known or properly discussed, amongst scientists right now. But we have been there and done a few of these things, and we know that they work.
Thank you very much. I would have about 34 or 35,000 more questions, but Garth would probably send some police over here to just drag me away. So I'm going to pass to Garth.
You're always welcome on our website. You're always welcome to pose questions, and I or some of my friends will try to answer them for you.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I've got to remember that. I did visit your website shortly before the show because, unfortunately, I really didn't know about it, and I'm so happy that we got this chance to talk. Thank you again.
I am as well, and I feel honored to have met you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And since it was brought up, one of our staff members is our resident law enforcement man of the shield, if you will. His name is Garth Holt, and I believe Garth might even take us in a different direction. What is your question for Mr. Ring, Garth?
Ralph, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Garth. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm just a dumb cop, so I'm not going to get all technical and all that stuff. I can't follow that. But I'll tell you what, you piloted a 45-foot disc for 10 miles. Man, you got to tell me about that. That's amazing.
All right. Okay. Briefly, or you want a few details?
Well, if you could keep it to where I could understand it, that would be great. Details. Yeah.
Remember, I'm a country boy. Everything's simple to me, and I got to talk simple language. But,
Hey, Ralph, this is Johnny once again. I think for the benefit of our listeners and some of the others that may be hearing you for the first time, it might be a good part for you to start at the beginning with your meeting up with Mr. Otis T. Carr and then move into the actual craft.
Perfect. Thank you very much. You're guiding me in the right direction. I would have jumped overboard. All right. Briefly, to get up to the point and the operation of the levity disc, or the circular foil craft. I, at Advanced Kinetics, after I didn't do so hot and I was told to go back to work, I worked another 2 or 3 weeks, and I wasn't sorry I left the job, but I was sorry when I had to face my wife and tell her I quit, because it wasn't getting anywhere. It wasn't my forte to sit there and do nothing. Even though I was getting paid quite handsomely, but I just didn't feel like doing that. So I met some people that belonged to a group called Understanding. They met once a week in the Santa Ana and Costa Mesa area, Newport Beach area. And the way I was invited, I told them what I had done. I said that, God, they don't, I thought I was doing good. I thought I'd get somewhere with this, and the engineers or whatever could go further with it. And I got flushed out of the whole picture. I didn't think that would happen. And they said, well, come on over and talk to the other people, because there's a lot of people like yourself that have got into certain areas of development and been stopped and criticized, et cetera, et cetera. So I did. I went over there and I told them, well, they said, well, what is your interest? Well, what are you doing? What are you here for? What's your mission? What are you trying to do? And I said, well, when I was a kid, when I came out of the woods and I saw all the automobiles and stuff, I was wondering why none of them were off the ground. And I just knew that if you took the wheel, the vertical wheel that we tear up the countryside with and have to put asphalt and cement down to run on, if we took that wheel and put it horizontal, then we could have floating homes and floating cities and floating countries eventually, quite simply by understanding magnetics. So they said, well, so you're interested in building floating homes? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, there's a guy out in Oklahoma City, Norman, Oklahoma, right now. He's in big trouble because they think he's a fraud and trying to extort funds for saying that he can build spaceships. His name is Otis Carr, and he claims to have been a protege of Nikola Tesla. He worked with Tesla for about 3 years. And he's in trouble, but he wants to finish his project. He's got small prototypes already working, and we, as a collective body, the Understanding Group and associates, would like to bring him and his entourage out here to meet you, and you guys can powwow on what you can do together. So long story short, they brought Mr. Carr, and he had engineers and physicists and PR people with him. They put us up at Lake Arrowhead for a while while they decided what in the world they were going to do with us. But it was a series of coincidences, or if you want to use that word, I prefer to say there's no accidents. When you're on the right track, everything seems to fall into place. They found us a laboratory set up in Hesperia, Apple Valley. It's next to Victorville, California, right in the middle of the desert, a big, beautiful facility. It had workshops, it had warehouse facilities and machine shops and offices and everything all ready to go. They said, okay, we got you a place to go to work whenever you guys are ready. So we jumped on it. We went down and set up our facilities and proceeded to build more prototypes to perfect it to a point of an understanding that we knew what we were doing. And I guess now, is that enough of the background? I can tell you what piloting was about it, or?
Sure, that sounds good, because at one point you guys have moved from from some of these small models and prototypes, and you now have built a larger, if I recall correctly, a 40-foot size craft to actually try to do a real-world experiment with. Is that not correct?
Correct. It was a 45-foot diameter. And before I get to that, I should put this in because it's important. On some of the small prototypes that we were building, we were operating around the periphery of Apple Valley, but we had gone basically as far as we could go with funds and everything, and we needed a manufacturer. We did have a working prototype that we wanted to present to somebody that would help us, you know, get into manufacturing these and slowly replace the automobile.
Right.
And we weren't threatening to stop anything, because we, you know, the Amish still have horses and people like their Maseratis, and all we wanted to do was, for those that wanted to get off the ground, we wanted to present what we have. So we, our PR man, his name was Wayne Aho, called General Motors and asked for a rep to come out and talk to us. So they sent him out. We met in Riverside, California, and he brought his entourage. He brought several, oh my gosh, engineers and physicists with him. And he said, well, what have you got? And we took a small 6-inch model that we had with us and just set it on his desk, and it was totally levitational. No noise, no moving parts, and sitting there. Well, right away, we got very skeptical, and they wanted to take our jackets off and stuff. They thought we had some kind of remotes that was that we were using to suspend this thing. And we said, no, that's what it is. That's magnetism. That's pure magnetism operating from an etheric technology, not a conventional technology. And long story short, we explained that we would be able to turn our plans and everything over to them if they would help us, you know, get into manufacturing them. And they could take as long as they wanted to get started, and we'd be glad to help them. Well, we didn't get very much further with the conversation before the rep kind of went through the ceiling. He said, "Well, you guys are crazy. You're outlaws. You're going to bust up the monetary system. I mean, our company pays hundreds of thousands of people around the world to do work to feed their families and children and schooling and you know, all those things going on. You can't do this." And the car said, "Well, if you'll give us a moment to explain, it's not going to be an overnight thing. It's going to take some time. And in the process of change, we'll be able to eliminate some of the toiling that people are into now to make a living, to feed their families and everything with the, device that we can eventually install in their homes that will give them, to keep them off the grid. The energy will not be a problem." And that's the main problem in any system of society, is the energy. So if we get them off the grid, then we'll give them a chance to find out who they really are, why they're here, and what they want to do. What are their natural talents? We might have brilliant Einsteins and Teslas and, oh my God, Mozarts embedded in people that are it's so far deeply buried that they only think of the time clock. I've got to get to work, and I've got to get home, and I've got to sleep, and I've got to eat. And this will replace all that in time and give them an opportunity to. And he questioned us. We told him they are no moving parts. On magnetic field, understanding magnetism, they can't crash. And he said, "Well, the insurance companies won't like that." I said, "Well, they can be run entirely self-sufficient on its own computerized system, if you will, or they can be run by consciousness." And this struck him as off the wall, upside down, and not. What am I talking about? Or what Carr was talking about? And he said, "Well, if you'll just put us into production on a very physical level and allow some of these crafts to be built, then the progression will take care of itself. You'll understand later what we're talking about." Well, long story short, he said, "You know, I'm going to have to ask you to leave, Mr. Carr, and I'll tell you one thing. If you guys put those up, we're going to shoot them down. You just can't, you guys are a menace to society. You're attempting to overthrow the monetary system, blah, blah, blah." So Mr. Carr very politely said, "Well, thank you for your time. I can see we're not of interest to you right now." And we left. And we went back to the lab, and we had some meetings, which we realized our time in then was very short, because we knew that we would be asked to stop our research and development, stop our productions, and so forth.
Right.
So,
it sounds like that they were basically in a very soft, threatening way, telling you that that this could possibly disrupt the whole economical world that they were used to.
Yes. Yes. In essence, that's exactly what they were saying. Yeah. Because with free and abundant energy, which is available, I mean, we live in a whole vacuum or a whole sea of energy, and we're just not using it the way it could be used. And the way we could be using it is through the understanding of what the ethers are, what is the ether, and how it relates to the physical environment, because protons and neutrons are changing rapidly every nanosecond. And
right.
When we understand how you can work with these things instead of against them, then we can have a world of, oh my gosh, endless, incredible lives that people can live and live in a state of joy instead of a state of apprehension or fear or doubts or anything else.
Which, you know, is a wonderful plan, and I'm all for that. We have probably about 15 minutes left here, Ralph. So let's fast forward to the part where we've got the craft built, and we're going to do our first real world experiment, if you will.
Okay, here we go. So Carr said we gotta cut to the chaff. We've gotta get rolling now, because we've got to get this out to the people to see that it's not a big mystery, it's not a big hoax, that it can be done, but we need their support. So we had two or three 45 footers. There was only one that was fully operational at the time, and I was a lab tech, that's all I've ever been, but I was also a gopher, so I'd go for hamburgers for the crew. But I was very close to Carr. Him and I understood each other on natural law like nothing I've ever seen or been next to since. And he said, well, I want you to be on the operation. And I said, fine, that's great. So him and two other engineers and I got on board the 45-foot craft, and in the center, as was mentioned before, there's a Utron electrical accumulator, and that Utron, just by its design, it's using the platonic solids in one solid state. It just by its design, using sacred geometry, it will accumulate, store, and distribute energy on an ether level. And I won't get into that right now if we've only got a few minutes left. But so he said, now sit around, clear your brain, because your brain is only going to confuse you. Your brain is a computer to operate the physical system, your body, and keep it all going, all your organs and everything. But it doesn't want to hear any airy-fairy or esoteric or quantum ideas. So you've got to get rid of your thoughts. Just go in there quietly, sit down, and meditate, or think, just don't think. But stare at the crystal ball in the center, and it was a big crystal ball, faceted. And up through the bottom of it was a laser. And when they fired the laser up, it put this thing into infinite colors, from infrared, ultraviolet to ultraviolet. And the colors were, my God, just, I could see yellow for 10 days if I wanted to. I mean, it was just infinite, all these colors. Well, in the interest of time, I'll shorten it, but he said, now just relax, and it's going to change colors, and when it does, just let yourself flow with the colors. Let your intuition just flow with the colors. So, and we didn't have cell phones in those days, and we had ham radios, but we weren't using them there, and so I don't even know how we were communicating, but we all remember hearing Carr's instructions. So we sat down, and they fired this thing up, and it eventually turned into the most beautiful aquamarine. I mean, the whole ship lit up inside, and we were just, you know, just, wow, this is great. and we weren't in it for just a couple of minutes, and we could hear a car saying, "Okay, that's it, boys, come on down for debriefing." So we looked at each other and said, "Well, we didn't go anywhere. We didn't do what happened. It must not have worked." Long story short, we got down to car. We went into the lab to his office, and we said, "Well, it didn't work, did it?" And he says, "You don't think you're dead? I told you the brain wouldn't. It doesn't. All it believes of is impossible. Anything out of its jurisdiction. So, what you did was operate on your mind." And he explained the consciousness is where everything's at. He says, "Empty your pockets." Well, we had these little jumpsuits on, and we emptied our pockets out. We had sticks and stones and grass and a whole bunch of stuff in our pockets that we'd picked up. And he said, "Well, if you didn't think it worked, where'd that stuff come from?" So we were flabbergasted. And he said, no, don't worry about it. Your brain will catch up someday if it wants to, but it's not going to believe it for quite some time that happened. And what you did was, beyond time and space, you teleported down from one point downrange to an area that the engineers had scoped out as an area resonating at the frequency of aquamarine. So you resonated the ship at the same frequency that was designated downrange, and you actually teleported. So we got into an area of discussion of consciousness, which he explained is who and what we are. He said, actually, we're living in a macro and microcosm environment here, and everything is being produced as you perceive it in nanoseconds or faster. And we asked him to explain that, and he says, "Well, you're not really here." You just think you are, and that's where your brain comes in. And everything around you is being created instantaneously. We're all at a tremendous velocities. We're spinning in vortexual motion at infinite speeds. But because we're all spinning on the same frequency, it seems like we're standing still. But really using in this dimension, the third dimension, our components, our senses, one being of the eyesight with our little cameras that are operating in the light spectrum at like 24 and a half cycles per second. So everything you see is being materialized instantaneously, but it seems like it's been here forever. But even in basic science and basic physics, it has been well known and is known now more than ever that the same glass of water you had 2 seconds ago is not the same glass of water it is right now, because everything's in constant motion. So, right. And that's thanks to Heisenberg, and the observation of objects and being able to change them. Well, anyway, so he said, "We've got to get this going, and the next flight is going to be over Los Angeles. We're going to ring bells and whistles and try and get people to really notice that, yes, this is possible." And before that happened, flatbed trucks is the only thing I can say, big semis of soldiers came in, and these cars, these black cars, and they pulled up to the place and said, "Well, we're going to have to..." They read a piece of paper to Carr that said, you are being asked to cease and desist or whatever it is. And Carr said, "Why? What's going on?" He said, "Well, you are attempting to overthrow the monetary system of the United States, and this could be considered high treason, and you are being held responsible for this. So we are confiscating everything as of now. And you're going into debriefing, and you'll be there for quite some time, and then you are ordered not to ever collectively come together or talk to each other again."
Wow.
So in a nutshell, I hope I got far enough along to explain. There's a lot of details in between. But
definitely. Yeah. Just a quick query, if I can, Ralph. Did they ever flash any appropriate credentials or anything? Did you know what agencies or was it perhaps a military-based type personnel that was talking to you?
Well, it was military, but I remember seeing FBI badges around their neck. So they had a federal, I don't know. But it was the military, for my take in the service, it was all military because of the way they did it. But the agents, if that's what you call them, went into our offices and started taking all our books and paperwork. And then the soldiers were loading up some of the stuff out of the shops and stuff. So, and later on, just a footnote here, later on down the line, I was in county, watching a lecture. I remember the professor's name, but he just got back from Los Alamos, New Mexico, and he was talking about all kinds of things that were going on because of the Freedom of Information Act, and he was going around finding everything out and coming around getting talks at colleges, and he happened to mention that he was privileged to go down. He was on the ninth level underground at Los Alamos, and he did see the OTCX-1, the 45-foot craft there.
Really?
And he had talked to some people about it, and he found out they were trying to mount weapons on it and trying to make it a scout vehicle or an assault vehicle, I guess it was, and. We knew that because in the magnetic field we were using, weapons are obsolete. They can't be used. And the only thing you can really do is love your work and love your all the energy you're working with, and that's what makes it work. And any fears, any doubts will negate its working. So they were frustrated because they couldn't get anything working on it. And what I found out later, they went to electromagnetism, and that's a very shortcut way, and it does levitate things, and they can operate in the visible and invisible spectrum, but it's not the magnetics that we were using at all.
Right. We've got ourselves about 2.5 minutes left, so why don't you tell everyone what is on the top of your mind right now? Are you still working on a number of projects?
Yes. I've never given up. I've never stopped working on them. We came from moving parts to solid-state circuitry, the digital. We now have what equates to pods all around the world, actually. We're in Hawaii. We're in Australia. We're in Sweden. We have different people that are waiting at the gates, if you will, like horses lining up for a horse race. And we're all ready to go to introduce this technology, this ether technology. It has to do with consciousness, and it has to be understood of who we really are. We're energy inhabiting a body that we created, and
right.
And but the energy is operating it, and we've always been and we always will be energy. But we're ready to go when people realize what they're looking at works. But as the rep said from engineer said, we're looking at it, but it can't work because of second law of thermodynamics. It can't possibly work, but it was working. Well, until people give us a break and find out that things work beyond the present civic laws and into natural law, everything is possible. There is no limit. And until they give us that break, and when they give us that break, we'll be able to give these things away, and they'll be able to run their homes and everything on free and abundant energy. And a lot of this is going to happen this year, before the end of the year. The world is going to change quite rapidly within the next 6 or 8 months.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And hopefully, and I say hopefully loosely, because I know the time is right for the acceptance of free and abundant energy. People have had it with being controlled by energy people and meters and so forth. So
very good.
Our time is coming.
Indeed. Ralph, we do have to wrap it up here before we go to the top of the hour break. Before we do that, tell everybody if they were interested into learning more about the pods and some of the other projects that you're working with, where can they go to get that information from?
Well, probably the best place is the website. Our webmasters are in Australia now. We had them in the United States, but we're moving quite rapidly through the areas around the world. And in Australia, they're rapidly putting up a lot of information that we weren't able to put on board before. So there's a lot of discs that they can download. There's a lot of information there. We have tons of stuff on Tesla technology and patents, et cetera, that he was responsible for.
Now, you don't charge for this, do you?
Oh, no. We don't ever charge for anything. We have our we want more than money, and that's love and energy coming back, reciprocal energy from people that are really interested in seeing a better world for everybody, and that's our reward.
Very
good.
So
there's no charge for.
Very good. Once again, our interview has been with Ralph Ring. You can check out more by going to his website at www.bluestarenterprise.com, Blue Star Enterprise, all being one word. And I'm going to toss it back to Neff, but Ralph, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line with us just for a little while. And once again, we certainly do thank you for joining us live on Above Top Secret Live.
It's been my honor and my privilege.
Indeed. Thank you, Ralph. You are listening to Above Top Secret Live, and it's time for a little break. This is the second of our Mondo Bizarros for the evening, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes.
We interrupt this program to bring you this special news report. Aliens have invaded the Earth. Stay tuned to Above Top Secret Live for more information. And stay vigilant.
Whoa, what's that?
It's the UFO at O'Hare Airport on AboveTopSecret.com.
The what? Where?
AboveTopSecret.com.
No, a real UFO in Chicago? Are you kidding?
No, dozens of people saw it, and AboveTopSecret.com has pictures and eyewitnesses, too.
Look, people are asking them questions.
Yeah, and if you join AboveTopSecret.com, you can, too.
When fantastic things happen to everyday people, they come to AboveTopSecret.com, the place where everyone can talk about anything. AboveTopSecret.com. Deny ignorance.
It's time once again for
Mondo Bizarro.
And here's what else has been happening in Mondo Bizarro. British brewers have created the world's first beer laced with Viagra to mark the royal wedding. Drinking just 3 bottles of Royal Virility Performance is equivalent to taking 1 of the blue pills, according to the makers BrewDog. The pale ale also contains extra aphrodisiacs, including horny goat weed and even chocolate. The label features the cheeky words, "Arise, Prince Willie." BrewDog has sent several bottles to Prince William for their wedding night. James Watt, the co-founder of BrewDog, said, "As the bottle says, this is about consummation, not commemoration. At this time, just 40 bottles will be produced initially and will go on sale on the 29th of April at BrewDog.com. Buyers will be limited to 1 bottle each due to the powerful effects. The firm plan is to continue the production if it proves to be successful." A moonwalking Romanian politician has been ordered to tone down his antics by leaders of his political party. Edmund Talmasian, age 40, inspired national headlines with his Michael Jackson-inspired moonwalk on a television show. Dancing is another kind of political message to appeal to the younger generation, that it is good to have fun, and that you can go to a disco and dance, Mr. Talmasian said. Party leaders, though, say enough is enough and have ordered him to tone it down. Despite the official disapproval, Mr. Talmasian is a popular figure in Romania. Traffic to his political blog has soared, boosting it from 49th most viewed to 7th in just several weeks. A high-profile Chinese author is planning to spend more than $150,000 on plastic surgery to make himself look like William Shakespeare. Zhang Yiyi will undergo 10 surgeries over a 10-month period to sculpt his face into the spitting image of the British playwright. Life is a process of striving to become a better person. I think the surgeries are worth the money, Zhang was quoted as saying. The surgeon set to perform the procedure said it would not be too difficult because Zhang already has a sculpted face with a sharp nose and deep eyes, similar to Shakespeare. The work would focus on his chin and his eyes, the report continued. Zhang's plan, first reported by China National Radio, was dismissed as attention-seeking by many Chinese internet users. Zhang is a controversial figure who once compared himself to China's great sage, Confucius.
Bizarro fact.
Back in 2002, having already cloned cattle, pigs, and goats, researchers at Texas A&M University moved on to house pets with the first successful cloning of a common house cat. At just 4 years old, Mozart was able to learn a piece of music in just half an hour. Only about one-ninth of the mass of an iceberg is visible above the water. Nearly all its bulk remains hidden beneath the surface. From the Strange Law Department comes this. In Oxford, Ohio, it's illegal for a woman to strip off her clothes in front of a man's picture. Back in the summer of 2003, the record-breaking heat wave in Europe killed an estimated 35,000 people. Temperatures reached 40 Celsius, or 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Every second, 630 steel cans are being recycled. In some Japanese restaurants, a bowl of shark fin soup can set you back $100. Well, that's going to do it for this installment of Mondo Bizarro. Stay tuned for more stuff as we turn it back over to ATS Radio.
There's no need for alarm. You're listening to
Car Crash Radio.
Car Crash Radio.
And now, coming to you live from the belly of the mothership orbiting your mind, here's the ATS Live crew. The British Maestro, Baz Badra, The Copper, Garth Holt, the godfather of ATS Radio, Johnny Anonymous.
You are indeed listening to Above Top Secret Live. This is Baz. We're into the third hour of the show. A big, big thank you there to Ralph Ring. Very much appreciated. If you missed his website, it is called Blue Star Enterprise. That's all one word. .com. Go and have a look. Give Ralph some love, because that was one of the most fascinating interviews I've had the pleasure to listen to, which is why I was so quiet, believe it or not. It's not very often that I go quiet when we get a guest on, but a lot of the things that were covered there is stuff that I've been doing research on for a very long time, and I believe that a few people in our studio here feel exactly the same way. And the comments from our chat room, somebody in there, I think it was Solar Esoja, described it as a life-changing interview, and I would agree with that. Some of the information that was put through there was extremely, extremely interesting. But we move on. We've let Ralph go. We're moving on. What I need to do now, very quickly, is find the right jingle. I was so into the interview that I completely and utterly got disorganized there, and I actually can't find it. That's not very good. I'll tell you what, while I'm looking for it, I'll do that. I'll do what I was going to do in a minute. We'll move forward, and we're going to pick up a couple of heavy political topics in this hour, and we're going to start off with one that hit our boards here on ATS very recently. The thread is called Ex Blackwater Guards Face Renewed Charges, and it's brought to us by ATS member Erong Garicuaro. Or Erong Garicuaro, that's it. And basically, this is to do with contractors, or civilian contractors, what we would call mercenaries over here in the UK, who worked for Blackwater in Iraq in 2007. and some nefarious happenings that went on over there. Now, Semper, are you there? Semper, talk to me. He's not there.
Yes, I am here.
Oh, you
no,
are.
I'm here. I was
you
muted.
Are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start off with this and give an indication of where we're going with this? Because I know you have your own views on this particular subject. So
yes, I do. Yeah. The thread actually is on AboveTopSecret.com. It is Above Top Secret member Aaron Garakuro. Yeah. Anyway, the thread title is Ex-Blackwater Guard Faces or Guards Face Renewed Charges. The quote in the thread is a federal appeals court on Friday reopened the criminal case against four former American military contractors accused of manslaughter in connection with a shooting that killed at least 17 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad in 2007. Now, some of the things that's happened, and I know Manny's been up on this too, but Blackwater was affected by not just these charges, but there were several other allegations that that came use of Blackwater. And I say the use of Blackwater on their own. They're actually I know a lot of people that have gone over there, not specifically for Blackwater. Most of the people I know went for DynCorp, but apparently there's been some shenanigans in some of these contractors going out of control over there. Now, my only reservation when it comes to this is having been, shall we say, in the thick of it. I really hate to use those words that everybody throws around, you know, combat vet and all that crap. But having been in the thick of it, I'm here to tell you that it's very easy to Monday morning quarterback to sit over here in the United States and to look at a report of what's happened and to make a summary judgment. So that's why I ask only that people be a little bit careful before you start throwing accusations around. And there's a lot of accusations around Blackwater. Now, I am going to say this. I have noticed as time has gone by and there's been more and more information coming over Blackwater that apparently the former Navy SEAL who's in charge of Blackwater, I forget what his name is, I'm sure Manny would know, is not maybe as careful as he should be when it comes to the people that he employs. So this one specific instance is they're overturning the appeals court. A three-judge appeals panel has disagreed with the decision of a former court who ruled that prosecutors have relied on tainted evidence and the Blackwater operatives were not going to have to face trial. However, the appeals court says no, that's not right. And so what we have now is a federal district court that's supposed to review the evidence against each specific defendant individually as opposed to, one large group. And the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is one of the more liberal courts of appeals, has stated that we find that the district court's findings depend on an erroneous view of the law, which, you know, is interesting. But again, you know, the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia is probably the second only to the San Francisco area. The group is now called XE. And now, I don't know if anybody has any more thoughts on this. I thought maybe Manny might have.
I do.
Okay.
But I'll let Manny go first. Go on.
Oh, no, I was far be it from me to interrupt the host. I would not dream of it.
Why stop that?
this is where that mute button comes in, isn't it?
It is. It's where the dump button comes in, that one. Okay, well, these people deserve to have the book thrown at them, and they deserve everything that is coming to them. These contractors or mercenaries left 17 Iraqi civilians dead in the middle of Baghdad in a place called Nizwar Square. These people are single-handedly responsible for the souring of relations between the United States government and the government of Iraq, and led to the government of Iraq requesting that foreign contractors are removed from Iraq. In my opinion, they shouldn't have been operating in the country in the first place. You know, and frankly, the decision not to prosecute them initially in 2009 was a US political decision to try and get these people off the hook for committing wholesale murder in the name of, well, operations in Iraq, brought about on the pretext of a lie. And that's my position on it. And frankly, these guys deserve what's coming to them. Now, I'll go on to Manny, you know, and say, Manny, what were your thoughts on that one?
I honestly I trust our judicial system to get to the bottom of the situation, because it's not impossible that not all of them were guilty. I'm willing to give anybody the benefit of innocence before guilt, regardless of the, well, maybe not regardless of what they're charged with. In this case, it seems to me, however, that this is kind of a day late and a dollar short. For one thing, in order for the United States to prove its good intentions, it would have been much more immediately beneficial to proceed with the judicial case much sooner. And they did. But it appears that when Eric Prince, and I think that's a name you were looking for before, Garth, when he stepped down right after he changed the company name to XE, which I can only assume is pronounced Z, I believe they moved their headquarters to Dubai. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But
no, he moved. He sold the business and moved.
Oh, and he moved himself. Okay, I wasn't sure. Right. I knew somehow he ended up there in that lovely paradise. The thing that bothers me is that this is just one case, and it's not being brought against the company. It's being brought against the individuals. I understand the individuals need to be punished, but once again, this brings up questions about corporate sovereignty. You know, in one way or another, the corporation has to be responsible for the conduct of its operation, you know, for the consequences of it. And it seems that the simple cosmetic change of the name, replacing it with a new board and removing the CEO, protects the company from the liability of what they did. And something tells me that's not exactly right. So that's where my objection lies. I don't see anybody in a queue.
I'd agree with your point there, to be perfectly honest. The question is, who hired
them? I don't understand that.
Who hired them in the first place?
The government.
Eric Prince did. He did most of the hiring. But my question here
No. Why were Blackwater in Iraq?
I don't think Eric Prince interviewed these guys for positions. I think they, this is pretty much your standard cookie cutter corporate affair. You know, you put out want ads, you get applicants, you have an HR department that screens them. You know, it's all systemic. I mean, I don't think Eric Prince knew these guys personally, or if he did, that would be a very interesting angle to the story. But it, to answer your question, if it's actually the United States government began contracting out to these agencies, which is actually kind of a lie. They had been contracting with them for years, even before the Iraq, Afghanistan, 9/11. They've been around for a while. Have they not? Okay, or am I mistaken?
Yeah. For decades. Yes, they have.
Yeah. But for them to be in Iraq, they would have been there on the business of the United States government, wouldn't they?
That is correct. Yeah. But as a corporation, they were shielded from the United States military code.
Yes and no. That's not always true. Okay, Blackwater is a free and independent international contracting corporation, and they can contract out to other countries. We have to remember that. Now, I believe that in this specific incident, these specific contractors were under contract with the Defense Department. However, there have been contractors that I know of that have worked for Blackwater and these other corporations that have contracted out to other companies, other countries, I'm sorry, or XE. Well, it was Blackwater at the time, Jack.
There's really no difference. Other countries, other companies, it's all the same to them.
It's all the same. Well, point being that if they were there on the business of the United States government after being appointed by the United States government to go there, then the United States government is directly responsible for the fact that this incident happened. And why aren't the people who appointed the contractors also in the dock. It seems a bit ridiculous to me that the individual civilians, and that's what these people are, the individual civilians are being prosecuted, and yet the people that appointed them aren't.
Why would they be?
Is that just me?
Why would
they
be? Why would the people who hired them? So, if they aren't...
Right,
let me ask you. In 1995, a major with the Delaware State Police went on a rampage with his... he was married, but this wasn't his wife. I don't know what you would call him, his honeypot. He was a captain also with the Delaware State Police, and they robbed four banks. Now, should the entire Delaware State Police be held accountable because of the actions of these two people?
No, because they were operating outside of the auspices of the Delaware State Police, whereas these contractors were in Iraq operating under the auspices of the United States government
carrying out security work. No, you can't say that because you don't know what they were instructed. It's quite possible, in fact, it's quite probable that they were instructed under the rules of engagement. And under the rules of engagement, you don't just spray into civilian vehicles. So if they were instructed that way, and now most of you know I contracted out as well way before this, but the rules of engagement are very clear. And if they were given the correct rules of engagement, which I'll go ahead and make the assumption they were, then they went beyond the rules of engagement, and the corporation is not responsible in any way, shape, or form because of the individual action.
I don't necessarily buy that idea at all.
Why? I mean, I don't understand.
I understand what you're saying. If they go outside of policy.
Right.
They're acting wrong.
Manny, if you hire me to come to your house and paint your house, okay, and you've told me what you want me to do is to paint your house vermilion orange, okay, and in the middle of painting your house, I pull a gun out and I kill your neighbor, all right, are you responsible for my actions?
Well, I didn't ask you to kill anybody.
Exactly. In fact, you asked me to paint your house. So these guys worked for Blackwater. They were told to do whatever it is they were told to do, which was guard these security. I'm sure they were transportation guards. That's what they were. They're actually guarding these convoys. And they were given, I guarantee you, they were given rules of engagement. There's whole classes you attend before you go over there. And then when they go over there and they violate what they were told to do by their corporation, corporation is no longer culpable in any way, shape, or form.
Johnny, I can see that holding
up. Yeah, quick query if I can. I'm curious about accountability. Let's say that in the process of doing their job, innocents are maimed and or killed. Who would be accountable for that?
If they were?
Yes, this company, not Blackwater, Exe, or whoever it is that's under contract, who is accountable for the deaths of the innocent bystanders?
Well, that would depend. I mean, when you're talking litigation, you're talking civil law. That's a whole different story. Now, as far as criminally responsible, they would be whoever pulled the trigger. And that's the problem with this trial. Apparently, they were unable on the first trial to show if all four or five or however many there were. Let me hold on a second. I've got it pulled up here. There were five. They were unable to show that all five of them engaged in this activity. So that's why it was initially thrown out. But if you're just talking about who is responsible for, you know, the civil ramifications, in other words, who could these people that have been maimed or killed, their families, sue, then absolutely they can sue Blackwater or Exe or whoever. Because civil culpability is completely different than criminal culpability.
Okay. All right. In my day job, I am a civil engineer. And in my day job, I am responsible for appointing contractors to do works. And those contractors have a duty to operate in a safe manner. Okay. And if I appoint those contractors to a site to work, I take responsibility partially for those contractors working in a safe manner because I have employed them. If they go out on site and somebody gets killed, I have a duty of care for the site. And if I could have done anything at all to prevent that site or prevent somebody from being killed on that site, I can be prosecuted for their actions because I haven't carried out my duties or my duty of care on the site. If you're in the middle of a war zone and you are appointing a contractor to do security works, and that contractor goes out and kills 17 civilians because of spurious rules of engagement, or because they may not have understood the rules of engagement.
You're making assumptions.
Yeah, I'm making assumptions. But if that happens, if those contractors open fire for whatever reason, and they have not been properly briefed on what's gone on, then whoever appointed them is then directly responsible for that action, for not ensuring that those contractors are capable of doing what they're told.
But your whole soliloquy, Neff, is again based on assumptions. We don't know. Perhaps their rules of engagement were proper and were specific and were thorough. At Blackwater employs thousands of people. Okay, so five miscreants misbehaved out of thousands of people. So, you know, I believe my assumption is better. I think I can assume that
you're making an assumption, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but my assumption has the numbers behind it. You know, all of these other people that are hired by Blackwater didn't do anything like this. So apparently they were taught well. So are we just going to assume that all of a sudden five just slipped through the cracks and they weren't taught well when all the other thousands were? You see what I mean?
Well,
you see where I'm going with this?
Makes no difference if they've acted in an irresponsible manner. It makes no difference how many of them it was. Does it?
Right. But if they acted in an irresponsible manner, that was their personal decision after being instructed properly not to, it relieves the corporate entity of any culpable criminal liability.
You think? Do you?
Yeah, I know.
Do you not think, and this is being raised in our chat room on AboveTopSecret.com, do you not think that the use of Blackwater security in Iraq was just an end run by the United States government to get around things on the technicality?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
These are the things we're aware of. Anybody that believes that this was just an isolated incident, or that only something singular like this happened in Iraq, this has to be very naive, don't you think?
But you got to remember too, Neff, that what do you think the biggest job is that contractors fulfill over there?
I have no idea. I assume a lot of it will be transportation and movement.
Truck driver. Yep. Truck driver. Second largest is cooks, cooking and preparation of food. The people that do this sort of thing, the convoy security, that's a fairly small percentage. Like what I did, I taught. That's all I did. I taught, you know, and the people who do this sort of thing where they're carrying all these weapons and all this other stuff, you know, it takes a special kind of warped individual, number one, to do that, you know, to constantly put yourself in harm's way. But, you know, the pay's good, you know, and you just most of the people that do this just get out of a 4 or 5 or 6 year contract with United States Armed Forces, and you know, where they're making something mildly over minimum wage, and then all of a sudden somebody offers them $100,000 or $120,000 or $140,000 or $150,000 to spend 11 months overseas, you know, so they may be culpable in that manner. You know, I'll give you that. They may be not, I don't want to say intentionally, but you know what I'm saying? They're drawing that sort of person in that's more likely to do something like this. But I still don't see how you can say the corporation is criminally culpable. Civilly, yeah, but not criminally. I don't see it.
Well, look at it this way. If it was members of the United States military that had carried out this act and killed 17 civilians in the middle of a square, you'd probably be looking at war crimes charges. But yes, because this 11. Is a private, because this is a private company contracted out, then the United States government can say, "Oh well, it was nothing to do with us. These are private individuals acting in, on their own merits." Yes, we hired them, but of right. course, you know, their company's, you know, responsible for this, and we're not. Do you not think that's a particularly sickly end run around the whole subject?
Well, it is. And I will actually agree with you on the fact that many of these security personnel are people who really just didn't fit in, you know, into the military. And then once they got out, they couldn't fit into civilian life because there are definite rules of engagement through the military. And if a military person had have acted like this, absolutely, they wouldn't be tried on war crimes. They'd be tried on United States military tribunal. But still, because we're not at war with that country, but. Yeah, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But still, what you're saying, absolutely. It's highly likely that the United States government is employing these sorts of contractors and encouraging that they use these sort of people in order to do things that they can't do. I can't argue that. Yeah.
Okay. Manny, you've got a point here.
Oh no, no. I'm sorry if I gave you that impression. Frankly, I think we could beat this horse to death. But the bottom line is, until the justice system, until the wheels turn, we won't know all the facts anyway. And the sad part about it is, this is going to be one of those we're going to have to wait and see what the courts do.
There's a lot of assumptions going on here, Manny. That's where my we're assuming that Blackwater didn't train them correctly, you know, because in order for Blackwater to be culpable, then you would have to prove that Blackwater did not train them, or not even train so much as just advise them, you know. Joey,
those guys usually work out there with at least one military person, or do they work on their own?
Not always. A lot of times on their own, especially for military or especially for civilian convoys, you know, there's just not enough military personnel to cover the convoys completely. So yeah. A lot of these contractors, you know, contract out for a small, and then they're very small units too. They're not, you know, where the Marines might send a company, you know, Blackwater would probably send a handful, you know, so huge difference there. Joey.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Garth, since you've worked contracting before, and probably have a little bit a better understanding of this than some of the others here. The security details, not just regular contractors, but the security details, the guys that are sent over there as, security for diplomats, security for some private companies and stuff. What are their rules of engagement? They do not have to follow the regular U.S. military or coalition force rules of engagement, do they? They have their own set of rules of engagement, and is that correct?
That completely depends. If they are contracted out by the U.S. military, they have to follow whatever rules of engagement the U.S. military has designated they follow. If they're contracted out to, say, Abu Dhabi or Abu Ghraib or one of the – you know what I'm talking about.
I understand what you're saying.
Right. Then they would operate under those specific rules of engagement. The problem is if you contract out to a country that's at war with another country, all right, that's illegal in the United States. You can't do that. Mercenaries are illegal. Okay, so they could lose their citizenship. So it has to be – A peaceful country, say, if Yemen is providing supplies to Iraq, which would be considered relief supplies, they can contract out to Yemen to guard those convoys because it's not a war act. It's not an act of war. Most of these contractors, and I'm pretty sure almost all of Blackwater is going to contract out to the U.S. military, and the U.S. military, or Department of Defense, I should say, the Department of Defense will assign them their rules of engagement.
Okay, so they would have to follow a Department of Defense, a Pentagon directive as far as the rules of engagement would go then.
Correct.
Okay. Absolutely. And that's all I really wanted to know, because I know a lot of the rules of engagement for the U.S. military over there are pretty tight as far as firing goes, getting into a firefight goes. So I was just curious if they would have been under the same restrictions as a U.S. Army squad or a Marine or something.
Yes and no. Yes and no. It's my understanding that the rules of engagement applied to contractors is not as strict as the rules of engagement applied to, say, a Marine unit. And if you read this and you read into this, what they're claiming is self-defense. They're claiming they were fired upon by insurgents.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the case that's being reviewed again.
Right. And they returned fire, and the civilians were just in the way. And see, that's such, you know, and here I'll side with Neff on this. That is such a convenient excuse, you know, and you know what I mean? You don't spray and pray, you know, not when you're around civilians. You have to make your shots count.
And that's why most military personnel, and these guys being ex-military for the most part, would know this, is that you're it's short bursts of controlled fire. It's not just unload a mag and see what happens.
Absolutely, because, you know, it the Marine concept that I was trained under and you know, I've carried through with my law enforcement career is it's better to let the bad guys get away than to kill one innocent civilian. Always better to do that, you know. So, you know, if you just got to turn tail and run, well, that's what you do, you know, as opposed to killing an innocent civilian, you know, and but you get this, you know, you get all this testosterone flowing and you get these macho people. And that's what you're dealing with here. You're dealing with these uber macho people that just, you know, they're there because they want the excitement, you know. Hey, Jack, you wind it up.
No, I'll wind it up. Very interesting thing, but I'm going to toss it right to Neff.
Yeah, I'll wind it up and just say, I reiterate my point that stands from the very start of this. Whoever did this, firing into a crowd of civilians, deserves everything that they get coming to them, basically.
Absolutely. I agree.
A professional, fully trained soldier acting in a responsible manner would not have done this. But I also do believe...
And if he was and he is guilty, then I say fry him.
I will say I just still do believe that the United States government is culpable for letting the maniac loose in the first place. Simple as that. However, let's move on and let's stay in Iraq, because believe it or not, we've all been lied to, possibly. Imagine that. Just imagine that. Some memos have come to light. Isn't it funny how these things always manage to come to light eventually? Doesn't matter how many times people want to try and hide things. Things just come to light. And memos have come to light exposing a link between oil firms and the invasion of Iraq. Now, the interesting things about these particular memos is that they are British, and these memos show a link from Tony Blair's government with regards to what they were going to do in Iraq with regards to strategic interests once a war had happened. Who wants to start off on this? Anybody? Manny, go on. You've got a question. Go for it.
Would that explain why Mr. Blair was so much of a cheerleader over this particular engagement, do you think?
Yes, I think it would.
But
you'd have to measure the impact on the British economy, right? We're assuming that this is for the benefit of all of Great Britain that he would do this. Or would it be less specific? I mean, less general than that?
I think it's not just based on British interests. And Skippy in our chat room has just said, wow, you mean it wasn't the evil US for once? Nice. Sorry, Skippy, but it was. The scuttlebutt about Iraq is that it's always been about securing oil supplies. And if you look at the reconstruction contracts and the way that the oil revenue, contracts were handed out, an awful lot of companies related to places like Halliburton and BP managed to get decent contracts. No bid contracts, in fact. So, yeah, there is something unusual here. But who was cute then? Was that Garth? Did you have a point? No, you did. Go on. Go for it.
Yeah. Hey, I'm just a cheerleader. I'm like, yeah, go, baby, go, baby, go. Yeah, protect our oil interests because I don't want to pay $6. And if it takes going over there to get this oil back down, we're the big boys in the block. We need to do it. And these little pissant countries that have the oil sitting underneath them that want to keep it from us or raise the price up so that I'm paying $6 or $7 in a gallon, well, I don't care what happens to them. I don't care how it happens. You know, if they want to play games, I like OPEC and I like the way they handle things, but if they're going to play games with it, then you know, we need to secure it. We've got to secure our future first. Sorry, but that's the way it is.
Who wants to respond to that? Jack, you always love responding to that kind of thing. I'm going to throw you
I know Garth loves his oil and all that. He likes protecting the oil companies and his low gas prices and all that. And we just had a guest out there that basically had technology that would eliminate the need for the oil companies in the first place. When you think about what Ralph was talking about and what he was by the authorities, you say you're threatening the monetary system. You're basically threatening the people that rule the globe, the people that have the money, the banks, and the oil companies. So what's I'm losing my focus. But the situation here is not, hey, you know, it's okay to go over there and just ravage, create war, take over countries to secure oil supply. We're better than that as a people, and by going with that mentality, you're just falling right into place with those oil companies. I wonder how much oil company stock Garth holds because he's such a.
I just wonder how many people that you want to put out of work would like to say to you.
That's a typical argument, Garth. That's just okay. A typical thing. Oh, well,
that's right. It's typical.
No, it's not. It's not right.
Rein it back in a little minute. Rein it back in a minute. Let's have some responses to this particular statement. Okay. 5 months before the March 2003 invasion, Baroness Simmons, the then Trade Minister, told BP that the government believed British energy firms should be given a share of Iraq's enormous oil and gas reserves as a reward for Tony Blair's military commitment to US plans for regime change. Now,
yeah.
Is that a way to run a government? Is that a way to run a country?
No.
Does Tony Blair have an awful lot of dead people's blood on his hands? Because I think he does. What do you think?
Yeah, it's typical. Look what's going on in Libya with the UK, France, Spain, Italy getting involved in that, the Libya situation. It's all strictly about the oil. BP secured huge contracts in the Libyan coast when they released the Lockerbie bomber. Oh, my goodness. You know, everything is tied to that. So I definitely do not agree with Garth as far as, you know, just go there and do it. Make sure my gas is such and such a gallon. That, you know, then you're just falling prey to what's been going on. I'm looking forward to the release of the free energy thing. Hopefully, you know, that's coming.
Yes. Doug, you've got some thoughts on this. Go on.
Yeah, I had to grab my mute button. Sorry about that. Garth brought up the point about this is all for cheaper gasoline, cheaper fuels. Well, we do need the fuels. I have no argument with him there. But the thing is, we don't need the fuels from the Middle East. The United States is sitting, and we know this from the oil companies themselves. The United States is sitting on massive deposits, some even larger than what's in Saudi Arabia, of our own oil. We won't use it. We would prefer to go around and fight these little countries just to, so we don't have to use our oil. Now, there's something seriously wrong with that in my book.
Definitely. There really is. And I don't understand why. Well, no. I do understand why this particular grab was made. I actually think it's more about geospatial positioning as well as oil, and having a power base in a particular region. There's a bit more to it than just the plain old oil, but it does appear that this particular event was planned a long time in advance. And that it was planned not because of weapons of mass destruction. And remember, everybody, it was weapons of mass destruction why people invaded Iraq. Wasn't anything else. Don't believe the bull that is put out there by politicians from certain political parties who will try and tell you it was all about humanitarian, it was all about regime change. It was about weapons of mass destruction that Donald Rumsfeld lied about, not just on national television, but on worldwide television. And if you don't believe me that he lied about it, go and look up the video that's on YouTube of him being interviewed, where he says, "We know where these weapons are." Go and look for it. Go and look at George Bush linking Iraq with nuclear weapons at every single possible chance that he had. And that was why people went into Iraq. That's why people died in Iraq. It wasn't about the oil, apparently. But now it turns out that it probably was. You know, you have been lied to. In fact, we have all been lied to. And with this Libya action at the present moment in time, we're probably still being lied to. That's the way it goes. And I know some people say, no, it's not only about the oil. No, it's not only about the oil. It's about, as I say, geospatial positioning. It's about having a piece of land to work off. And that's the way it goes. But yeah, don't fall for the line. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Don't believe it was anything to do with 9/11. Because it wasn't. Because there was no link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Certainly don't believe it was anything to do with weapons of mass destruction, because none have ever been found. End of story. Simple.
Yeah, I can add to that, especially on the angle you're talking about. With WikiLeaks, the releases of the files, there was an issue there with Saddam Hussein, you know, who was, you know, the best friend of the United States, you know. We were sided with him, armed him, weaponized him in the Iran-Iraq war. It got to a point where I think it was Bahrain, I think the country invaded, was doing the new technology angle drilling into Iraq to extract oil. And he, from those releases, he was Hussein was pissed. And I... You know, I don't blame him for being, you know, angry, because that was one of the major revenues for the country. And despite all the efforts, and he sat there and, you know, discussed it with our diplomats and basically saying, hey, this has to stop. They can't take it. They're taking our prosperity from our country. So he was pushed into a corner. Then he decided, boom, I'm going for it. I'm going, you know, to Bahrain, invade, or Kuwait. I'm sorry. It's Kuwait. And that's what started that whole deal. So even the first Gulf War was about the oil, and Iraq was demonized for that. You know, it's taken years, and you know, with the release of information now, it becomes clear, you know, what happened there, and it's just. It's frustrating for me, and I'm sure it's frustrating for a lot of the listeners. It's all about oil, who controls it, and all that. This isn't, you know, and we had, I was in the Army, Garth was in the Marines, Manny was in the military as well. And, you know, we're out there being sent to do things which really doesn't have to do anything with defending the country. They're sent out to defend corporate interests. And, you know, I'm sure, well, at least for me, that's not why I raised my right hand. But,
okay. Garth, go on, have a rant. Go on, I know you want one. But I'd be warned,
well,
before you do have your rant, that I'm going to have one afterwards. Go on.
Well, of course you are. And if I was hosting, I'd have the final word. That's how it works, isn't it? You know, I hate to really. Rants. I hate to quote a movie, you know, because it's so apropos, but, you know, it seems like no one anymore is willing to do what it takes. And you see, it's not just that simple. You know, I wish it was simple enough to say, okay, well, I raised my hand and this isn't what I understand what Jack's saying. I do. I understand it. I feel for him and it gets my heart. The problem is the real world. It's not like that, because in the real world, if you have a politician who stands up and says, we're not going to do this, and all of a sudden people can't afford to drive to work, that politician gets voted out. So it's not the politicians, people. It's us. It's the citizens of the United States who demand that some of this happens. Okay. It's not the politicians. It's not even big oil. Because big oil wouldn't be big oil if there weren't the literally millions of us willing to pay for the gas that they're producing to go driving on our vacations or to hop in my car and go down to McDonald's when I get hungry. Because that's how it works. It's not big oil. It's not the politicians. It's us. It's the people in the studio. It's the people in chat. It's me. It's everybody that demands gas prices be under $5 a gallon or $6 or whatever the heck it's going to go to this year. And I'm telling you, when it happens, people are going to go insane. And Jack, maybe it's not you, but you know what? You're a lone voice in a wilderness. Because of the 350-some million people in the United States, I'll raise my hand and guarantee you 300 million of them disagree with you. All right? They want cheap gas. They want gas to be able to get to work. In the economy the way it is now, if gas prices go up another dollar, you're going to go from a recession to a depression because people are going to lose their jobs. Or how about this? How about we shut big oil down? And then all of a sudden, we've got 30 million people out of work, more than we have now. Yeah, it's easy to sit here and defend these altruistic values and say, oh, I hate big oil. I hate what happened in Iraq. I hate this. I hate that. Blah, blah, blah. But if you live in the real world, it's not like that. You know, if you live in a real world, your neighbor comes over to your back door and borrows money once a week or so they have enough money to drive their 72 Ford pickup down to a construction job where they're making minimum wage because they can't afford gas prices at $3.65 a gallon. And if it goes to $5 a gallon, my neighbor is going to lose their job because I can't afford to supply their gas. They can't afford to pay their gas. So as harsh as the reality is, you can be as altruistic as you want to. It's not the real world. We can sit around and cry about these soldiers. We can cry about this politicians, big oil, you know, and I hear it till my head explodes because it's not the real world. The real world says we have got to have oil right now. Okay, we can't all have flying saucers. I don't know why. It doesn't matter. We just can't. And we can't. Wind energy doesn't work. Solar energy doesn't work. The only thing that works is oil and coal and nuclear. And until they make a nuclear engine that can fit inside of a car, you know, because just people think they got these electric cars and they're plugging them up. Where do they think that electricity comes from? It comes from an oil power generating plant or a coal power generating plant or a nuclear power generating plant. And you can't have nuclear power plants because the tree huggers won't even let us build them. That's the problem. It's the real world. Neff, okay. Over to you.
You've had your rant. I'll have mine. Yes, it's the real world. This is the real world where we wage war for resources because people want cheap gas in their cars. This is the real world where the Western advanced technologically nations can't be bothered to invest in different sources of energy and would rather throw money at pulling liquid out of the ground. This is the real world where people have to die so that you can put oil in your car in the form of gasoline. It's not a very nice world, is it? Really, if you think about it. Now, in our Above Top Secret chat room, somebody has raised the issue that I always blame America for these things. Obviously, that person wasn't listening because I absolutely slated Tony Blair's government for being involved in this from the start. This business in Iraq wasn't just carried out by America. It was carried out by a number of nations. And I am not blaming the United States wholly for this. In fact, to be perfectly honest, the nation I hold in the most contempt for what happened in Iraq was mine. Because frankly, if my government hadn't backed you in America, you would not have gone into Iraq. Because while you have the military, sometimes you need the political support as well. And without Britain's political support for that action, I don't think the Iraq war would have happened. Because the French didn't want it, the Russians didn't want it, the Chinese didn't want it, and every other civilized, advanced Western nation was against it. And if the British government hadn't have got married to George Bush and decided to support this action for regime change so that they could make a grab for the oil, wouldn't have happened. Simple as that. That's some rant. What do you think about that then, Semper? How do you like dem apples, eh, buddy?
Okay. I appreciate your opinion, Neff. And, you know, we agree on more things than you know. We really do. And you know me. You know me. I've got a huge heart. And I wish everything you said was true. You know, and I wish that everything you said fit into the real world, but it just doesn't. You know, it's sad. I agree. I lost friends over there. You know that. You know, I've told you that before. It's horrible, but it's the world, you know, and I don't know how to fix it. I wish I did. I really wish I did. I just don't, buddy.
I think, well, to be honest, I think the way to fix it is for people to actually start realizing that what they put in their cars they don't actually need, because we have, as I say, we're technologically advanced nations. We are perfectly capable now, I believe, of going out and finding a different way of doing this, and the only reason that has not been done is because there is no profit in it for oil companies, and the oil companies have the power. And the power needs to be taken away from the oil companies. And once that happens, then things will change.
Neff, I got a question for you.
Go on.
To hell with the oil companies. When was the internal combustion engine invented? All right, or even more importantly, when was the steam engine invented? Because we've not truly advanced technologically since the late 1800s. Exactly. You know, every single car out here, regardless of its technology that may have been added to it, is a basic internal combustion engine. And every single electric plant across the world is nothing but a steam engine. Well, tell me we can't come up with something that, you know what I mean? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Isn't it just?
I mean, it's
absolutely it crazy.
It is.
It really is. It is absolutely nuts that we haven't progressed. And a lot of people say, well, isn't technology wonderful? And we've done this and we've done that. But actually, what you drive around in hasn't changed for 120 years.
Since the 1895, I believe, was the initial internal combustion engine, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. You know, and we could still be. I mean, that's the other thing. There are different methods of doing it. There is clean coal technology now where we could be burning coal and running turbines and stuff like that off coal power. And there's more coal than there is oil. And we could be doing all of that, and we don't do it. Why? Because the oil lobby has the power. Simple reason. Mm-hmm. And there are the hydrogen fuel cells. There is hydrogen itself, which I still maintain can be used to run a vehicle safely. And people come up with all sorts of reasons why. But then again, if you think that hydrogen's flammable, just go and throw a match in your petrol tank or your gasoline tank and see what happens to it. You'll find out how flammable that is as well. You know? And that's not an endorsement from me. Don't go and do that, by the way. But just think about it. Guys, we're out of time. Again, the show has flown by.
Great show. Yes.
Absolutely flown by. And what a great guest Ralph Ring was, don't you think? Do you not think?
Oh, amazing. Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Absolutely. I'm sitting here feeling more honored than I have ever felt. That's really
well, nice. Manny, I'll let you come on again sometime. Thank you for that,
Manny. Oh, you're welcome. You know how it is.
Oh, you were talking about something. I'm sorry.
The chance to bask in your glory has come and gone again.
Oh, what a show. What an absolute show. We've talked about being bugged. We've talked about the police not necessarily being straight with people. We've talked about technology run by perception as well as by raising its vibrational state. And we've talked a bit of heavy politics about what's gone on in Iraq. And guys, it's been a hell of a show. Say goodnight to the listeners because it's time to wind things up.
Good night, listeners.
Good night to the listeners because it's time to wind things up.
Good night, everybody.
Before we go, I believe John,
it's time for the Above Top Secret Live Chat Room Shoutout.
Indeed it is. And in our chat room right now, listening to the show, is Advantage, Agarta, Ahab Star, Alicia.Angel, Blue Moon 2, Boncho, Cobbs, Chakote, Damad, Dave Spanners, Fractured Facade, Helig, Helmet, I Do Not Collect Stamps, I'm a Marty, Irish Last, Jeanne Anonymous, Matthew Dark, which is Michael Light's cousin, believe it or not, Mirthful Me, Monkey See, Monkey Do, Nevermore, Neonitis, Nikolai, Omega Logos, Optimus Primal, Piano Praise, Roger Steigers, Silk, Senator Claus, Skippy 1138, Thinking Cap, Truth Seeker 1984, Virtuoso, X-Rad Exix, Zassafras, and a couple of numerical unknown mystery guests that are also a hand. Back to you, Neff.
And we love our numerical unknown mystery guests. Thank you, guys. The reason we leave that for the very last thing in the show is because we love you, and we want you to know how much we appreciate you being there in our chat room. And as I've said before, if you're listening out there and you aren't a member of TopSecret.com, come and join us, and then you can be a part of the chat room. It's been wonderful in there this evening. There's been all sorts of things going on. It's time for us to go, though. I'm going to play us out with, well, me. My band, a new single from my band, and this features the extremely wonderful and talented Stroby. Stroby, Heather, hope you're feeling okay. Get well soon.
And if you're not, featuring, contact me at Garth Holt at, oh, never mind.
Yeah. This is Illustrial featuring Strobe Girl and February Sun. Good night, everybody. We'll be back the same time next week.
Bye, people.
Can you feel that winter's done? When will we see you, sun? Can you feel that winter's done? Show me February sun. Show me February sun.
Presented by the hosts and guests of ATS Live do not necessarily reflect or represent the views of the Above Network LLC or AboveTopSecret.com.